Going to call to order the meeting. We still do not have a quorum, but it's 10:15. So we are going to start looking around the room. I think the only author in the room right now is Representative Fabian. So we will start with his House file, 1230. Oh, Representative Drazkowski, I'm sorry. You're sitting in the dark back there. There we go. Welcome to the committee, Representative Fabian. We will take testimony on your bill. If when you conclude we still don't have a quorum, then I'll just lay your bill on the table and we'll wait until we have a quorum to take the vote. The Ways and Means Committee generally just focuses on the fiscal component of your bill, so if you'd like to give us a brief overview with that in mind, we would appreciate it. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. House File 1230 really is a non-controversial bill. I know Representative Hornstein will be glad to hear that. This is the lands bill that's carried every year through the legislature, as I understand it. You have the fiscal note in front of you, and because of the technical nature of the bill, what I'd like to do is turn this over to Kathy Lewis. She can explain the aspects of the bill a lot better than I can. If there's any questions with regards to the fiscal note or the land exchanges and the sales and the purchases that are going on, she would be very good at answering that. So right. With that, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Fabian. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Lewis.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Kathy Lewis, Assistant Director, Lands and Minerals, Department of Natural Resources. As Representative Fabian said, this is the 2011 Omnibus Lands Bill. When it was introduced, it was a DNR bill that had provisions, and still does, for regarding the changes in boundaries of state parks, recreation areas, and state forest, and authorizing the sales of certain DNR state land. Through the hearing process, as usual, other bills have been added and incorporated into this bill. It's primarily the sale of tax forfeited lands by several counties. There's also been an addition for modifying the Mississippi River Management Plan for the city of Dayton, clarifying which rules are involved, and also a small land sale for the Department of Transportation. Overall, the fiscal impacts concern the sale of property. For the sale of the DNR properties, the revenue is modest. We have a very small selection this time of state lands being offered for sale, and we're estimating an overall revenue of $16,000. The other fiscal impact is the county tax forfeited land sales. We don't have statistics from the counties on the revenues from those tax forfeited land sales. The revenue goes to the local taxing districts, and there are substantial parcels being offered for sale in Carlton, Lake, and St. Louis and Pine counties. But the fiscal impact is revenue generation as opposed to any cost to the state.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Lewis. Members, we do now have a quorum. I'll officially call the meeting to order. Mr. Smith will note the roll. Representative Pawlowski moves approval of the minutes from April 4th.
Madam Chair, I haven't read the minutes, nor do I have a folder, so I really don't wish to approve something I haven't seen. Thank you.
All right. We will get you a folder ASAP. Representative Nornes looks like he's ready to move the minutes from April 4th and 5th. Members, are there any additions or corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor of the minutes from April 4th and 5th say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The minutes are adopted. I will now move Representative Fabian's bill, House File 1230, to be considered by the committee. Ms. Lewis has just got done giving us an overview of the bill. Are there any questions on House File 1230? Representative Rukavina.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Fabian, you may recall when you came to me with this bill, I told you this is a good bill to carry because, you know, if you hold it long enough on the floor, everybody can solve a lot of their problems, and I try to do that every year with this bill because I always seem to have problems with the Department of Natural Resources. So now in front of me, Ms. Lewis, I have a letter from a gentleman who's got a lease through state land, particularly school trust land, and you know, the lease members, this is about 2.5 miles of road that was built through state and county land. I contacted Mr. Myers about a month ago to try to resolve what I thought was an unfair issue, and to date I haven't gotten anything but a letter from the gentleman the other day, finally, whose lease has gone from $147 in 2005 to he was given a lease in 2010 in August of $1,395 to pay through the 2006-2010 period, and then he received an invoice in December for another $1,525, but that was lowered down to $1,350. And members, the DNR didn't build this road. They don't maintain this road. They use the road along with the federal government and the county to get into it, and they ruin it. And I just don't understand why, because I will bet you all the money I have in my wallet, but I bought gas this morning, so that's not much, that hardly any of this $1,525 makes it to the school trust anyhow, because most of it's charged off as it gets there. And Representative Fabian, I didn't get a chance to talk to you because I just saw this letter before I left for the weekend, but I want to offer an amendment to your bill later on to rectify this problem, because I haven't gotten any response from the DNR, and so I got to protect my constituents with what I think is very unfair application of an easement. And Madam Chair, you know I always do this, so it's you know, I hope you're not mad at me, because I do this rather Representative Carlson, or you are the chair, because I have no other place to do it at. And so while I have the floor to Ms. Lewis, can you tell us on these leases that are going to go back, or excuse me, on the minerals that are going to go back to the different accounts that purchased those mineral rights at the off-road vehicle park in Gilbert, what kind of an agreement do you get, and what kind of payments are there by these exploratory companies, and what's the terms of the lease if they get awarded a lease, and how much money goes back into the to this account or school trust or wherever? Because there were a number of leases members issued just last week for copper nickel exploration, not only on state-owned land, not only on county tax forfeit land, but on people's private land where they own the surface but they don't own the minerals. And I am puzzled as to why we are even having the DNR go out and offer leases on copper nickel mining when we've got two companies that have been wanting to mine for 6 years, don't have a permit, could mine for 30 or 40 years on those different sites, and why we have to be going to private auction of mineral rights on private land. So, Ms. Lewis, can you just quickly give me a little idea of how all that works?
Ms. Lewis.
Madam Chair, Representative Rukavina, members, the section Representative Rukavina refers to is section one of the bill, which concerns the OHV area near Virginia. When the state acquired a 20-acre parcel there, we also, in that case, acquired the mineral rights, and we have issued a non-ferrous metallic mineral lease. So the purpose is to clarify the revenue goes back to the fund from which the lands are purchased. State has the fiduciary responsibility through the DNR to manage the state-owned mineral rights, and we have regular leasing programs to offer lands for leasing. The lease process has a check and balance in it. All metallic mineral leases have to be approved by the State Executive Council, which is our five constitutional officers. The lease form itself is set up in rules adopted through the administrative rules process. The lease form that is used is set in rules, Chapter 6125. There's a base rental rates that are in the lease. They start out low to encourage exploration. They increase during the term of the lease to encourage companies to finish up their exploration and move to mining or to cancel the lease. They start out at $1.50 per acre per year. For the first 2 years, the remainder of the year of issuance, then it goes to $5 per acre, then to $15, then to $30. The revenue on the school trust minerals goes right away, 80% goes to the corpus of the Primus School Fund, and 20% goes to the minerals management account. At the end of the fiscal year, the portion of the minerals management account that's over $3 million is split between the school trust and the University Trust in proportion to the mining that has occurred on those two types of lands. So most of the revenue from state mineral leases does go into the funds from which the lands are derived. So that's kind of the basics for answering the question, but I can respond in more detail if needed.
Representative Rukavina.
Madam Chair, Ms. Lewis, so I understand this. I know that most of the mineral leases go right into the school trust. In fact, 100% of them used to go in the school trust until a few years ago. But my particular question is, does this money go into that forestry suspense account like it used to go in, and then, and are all the charges charged off on these particular $1.50 an acre to $5 an acre? Are all the costs charged off before the 80% goes in?
Ms. Lewis.
Madam Chair, Representative Rukavina, no, the mineral release revenue does not go through the forest suspense account. The 80% goes straight to the corpus when the revenue comes in. The 20% of the minerals management account is subject to an appropriation by the legislature. We don't certify our costs in the manner that the forest suspense account does. It's an appropriation from the legislature from the minerals management account for the minerals management activities of the department. And that was a decision made by the legislature a few years ago that instead of the general fund bearing the cost for the school trust and university trust management, the funds should bear that cost. And but no, we do not go through the forest suspense account.
Representative Rukavina.
Madam Chair, thank you. Ms. Lewis, does that road easement go into the forestry suspense account?
Ms. Lewis.
Madam Chair, Representative Rukavina, yes, it does.
And
Representative
what,
Rukavina.
Madam Chair, and what would you estimate out of the $1,350 you're asking a constituent to pay of mine goes into the, when everything's said and done, does $100 go in there?
Ms. Lewis.
Madam Chair, Representative Rukavina, currently the costs for forestry are significant, and a very small amount of net revenue goes into the corpus from the forest suspense account.
Representative Rukavina.
Well, you know, members, that's my point here. You know, when all is said and done, the kids don't benefit anyhow, and I've got a bunch of aggravated people who have put thousands and thousands of dollars to build the original road and then thousands more to maintain it after the logging trucks drive on it to log the kids' timber, which, by the way, never gets into the forest into the account either. And it's very frustrating to me. Ms. Lewis, it's not your fault. I know you're following statute. One last comment, members. You know, they're drilling in what's called the Virginia Horn. That's where the iron formation goes like this around Virginia, Neveleth, and Gilbert, and Mountain Iron. And if we can't site a copper-nickel mine in the middle of nowhere east of Hoyt Lakes where there's absolutely no people, how are we going to ever site a mine in an area that's about 3 miles square between four towns? I just don't it boggles my mind that people are doing this. There's no no sense to it. It's just to get money into the agency to have people doing things. There's no need for any of this. It's if no money is going into the school trust from selling timber, why don't we just do what some of the people at this table would love to see and let the timber grow up, fall over, get old, the birds can live in it, and then the trees can die, and move on? Because if nothing's being accomplished and no money's going in the fund, I just don't see why we have to spend all the agency time doing these things. And so that's my comment, and I'm perplexed, but, you know, nonetheless joyful here today. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Rukavina. Representative Viskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Lewis, as I look through the sections, I see we're expanding some state parks. Section 3 expands boundaries. Section 4 deletes some boundaries. Section 7 and 8 delete some acreage, but then add it back to another park. Bottom line, Ms. Lewis, the net effect of this bill, are we going to have more or less acreage in the public's hands?
Ms. Lewis.
Madam Chair, Representative Viskins, The Section 7 and 8, let me start there, don't increase or decrease state-owned land. It's changing state-owned land from the state forest to the Roseau Lake WMA, so that has no impact. Section 6 is already currently state-owned land. It's putting it within the state forest boundaries. So you're basically down to Sections 4 and 5. Of the bill, the expansion of Scenic State Park is 29.9 acres, and William O'Brien is 13, and Greenleaf Lake is 4.4, and Iron Range is 40, and then there's about 4 acres being deleted from the Hayes Lake State Park. So the boundaries expanding overall for those parks and state recreation areas, but the bill doesn't provide the appropriation for purchasing those lands. That has to come through another appropriation act from the legislature.
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any additional questions of the bill author? Representative Fabian, any additional brief comments?
Yes, Madam Chair. Just real quickly, in response to Representative Biskin's comments, I would like to, and this doesn't happen frequently with me, but I would like to thank the DNR. For example, the four-acre parcel that they are giving up out of Hayes Lake State Park is the result of the survey that they did, and they found out after doing the survey that the property line actually goes right through the middle of a cabin that's on that was on private land, and now as a result of the survey, you know, that's what's happened, and they were selling the land back to the landowner, you might say, so that we could get the cabin out of the park. So,
thank you, Representative Fabian.
Thank you.
There are no other questions. I will renew my motion that House File 1230 be recommended to pass and refer to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion's adopted. Thank you, Representative Fabian. Representative Drazkowski, House File 66. Members, we will work our way through the agenda as far as we can get this morning. The two bills that will not be heard this morning are Senate File 509, House File 210, the Kiffmeyer bill on voter ID, and the House plumbers license fees modified. Those will be after session, no earlier than 6 p.m. This evening. Representative Drazkowski, welcome to the committee. I'll move House File 66 for consideration by the committee. This particular language was included in the tax omnibus bill in its entirety, and so I don't know that there'll be a lot of questions, but this is pretty straightforward, repealing the political contribution refund program. Are there any questions on House File 66? Representative Carlson.
I'd like to yield to Representative Greiling, if that'd be all right.
Certainly. Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Drazkowski and members, prior to being in the legislature, had many hats, and one of them was president of the local League of Women Voters and vice president of the state League of Women Voters. So I spent a lot of time looking at good government issues. Some people might say that's a part of why she is how she is here in the legislature, and I would agree. And one of the things I'm most proud of is the good government hat that I wear here. And the statute that Representative Drazkowski is repealing is repealing good government. This is has been a big centerpiece of why we have in Minnesota such clean government compared to Washington, D.C. And I think that having special interests have a cap and a curtailment on their involvement in our decisions here, and having little people, the average person, have a chance to contribute as much as $50 and cumulatively have just as much effect or more effect than special interests is a big boon to the good government here in Minnesota. I myself don't take PAC or lobbyist money, and having people be able to get back $50 for this part of my being a good government person, I think is a very good investment in government dollars. This was a huge reform in my first term in the legislature, and now I can see why Representative Druskowski in times of need, like last year, where we bipartisanly agreed to suspend the funding of the program because of our huge deficit. You know, that's one thing that can be talked about. But to actually repeal the law, I would urge us to vote no on this. This is a huge step backwards and a huge step towards bad government.
Thank you, Representative Greiling. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I would also encourage a no vote. And there's a couple of us on this committee that were here when this law was enacted back in the early 1970s. And it was a part of the good government movement, and quite frankly, there was a lot of discussion at the time because of Watergate. And one little footnote, by the way, too, is that Representative Greiling, when she was involved with the League of Women Voters, had a guest speaker out in her area, because I was quite involved with this issue at the time, and I happened to have been the guest speaker when I had a meeting with the League out in Roseville. But at any rate, this was part of a total package. Part of that package was to put a cap on contributions, how much money you could get from a single source, and also a cap on aggregate contributions from PACs and so on. And to offset that was the issue of the rebate, as I sometimes call it, to encourage small contributions. $50 per person, $100 per couple. And it was to try to get the influence of big money, if you will, out of campaigns. And so I would encourage a no vote, and as I think Representative Riley pointed out, the funding of the program might be one question temporarily, but to absolutely repeal the program is quite another.
Thank you, Representative Carlson. Representative Viskin.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Representative Druskowski, I philosophically agree with this bill that you have in front of us, but I do have a question. What do you then do with the $12 million that is annually gone to this program?
Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Biskins, the reason for bringing this is about helping us set priorities here in the legislature. Mm-hmm. This money then would be available for us to use for our priorities, funding nursing homes, group homes, roads and bridges, public safety, and education.
Right. Representative Biskins.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Druskowski, we probably have a different philosophical understanding on this then, because if it's no longer necessary for the uses it was collected for, then I believe it probably should go back to the taxpayers. But I will be supporting this and hopefully working with you as we move forward.
Representative Lanchesky.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, maybe this question for you or Representative Davids. I'm just looking at the actual bill, House File 66, and following the process the bill took. I'm recalling it was the very first couple of weeks in January that we heard the bill, or the bill got sent to taxes, and then taxes heard it first. And I think the discussion there was, you know, this needed to go other places, and it did, and now it's been, you know, actually got all the way to GovOps and then was moved to pass. Then got re-referred back to this committee when folks realized, you know, money might be involved. But I'm trying to understand really the intent in all the tax vehicles going to the floor. There's been so many this year, and maybe it's for Chair Davids, but, you know, this bill, of course, would make all tax amendments on the floor germane. We'd have another tax day, and this bill already passed in both House File 130, which was vetoed, and now it's in your House File 42. But just trying to understand, is there a reason for all these tax bills going to the floor separately? I really haven't seen that before. It helps the minority, honestly, when you take them up on the floor, because then all the tax amendments are germane. But just my guess is that's not really what you're doing. Is there any, what's the goal here, I guess? Just trying to figure it out.
Well, Representative Lanchesky, we're just moving some bills to the House floor. We like this one. We think this one's important, and we don't know what's going to happen to some of the other tax bills that have been moved to the floor, so we're just trying to be prepared.
Okay. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Druskowski, you may be the chief author of the omnibus tax bill by the end of the day, but I just am just trying to figure out the process here with this
well,
kind of bill.
Representative Wanchesky, I don't think it'll be by the end of the day, but
the end of a different
maybe
day.
The end of the month.
End of the year.
All right. Representative Greiling, did you have an additional comment?
Madam Chair, thank you. I just wanted to ask for a roll call.
All right. Roll call has been requested. Representative Breinhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Druskowski, in your response to Representative Biskins, you addressed the financial issues in the sense that how you might reprioritize the money, but you really did not address the motivation for the entire repeal of this language. I'd like you to do that.
Madam Chair.
Representative Druskowski, I don't think she was asking for your motive, but maybe an explanation of the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Breinhart, we're going to need to have our priorities set in the long term as well. So I think those same comments in terms of us taking the limited resources that we have today and in the future and focusing them on what our priorities and strong, legitimate functions of government is really what we'd like to do, what I'd like to do with this bill.
Representative Breinhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you don't consider, you consider this primarily a fiscal decision and not an ideological decision. And I guess I'd like you to respond to some of Representative Greiling's considerations around this as a good government bill and the purpose of this legislation in terms of extending the involvement of citizens in the political process, et cetera.
Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Representative Greiling, I also don't take any PAC or lobbyist dollars, and really the motivation for the bill was a fiscal one. It was, I think it needs to be as we set our priorities in the long term. Nothing about removing this program in the long term will prevent people from being involved in the political process. And actually, we had a much more elaborate discussion in taxes about that. But that's all I have, Madam Chair.
Representative Carlson.
Well, Madam Chair, when Representative Biskins used to ask me in the Finance Committee about certain bills, and this is in response to your response to Representative Wanchesky, I would just say we were going for a drive.
Well, he
may remember that meaning a vehicle.
And if you look at today's agenda, we might be able to equate it to one of those car carriers that goes down.
The several.
Okay. So, anyway, Representative Westrum.
I'll pass, ma'am.
Thank you. I have no other. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Eakin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to speak to the bill as well. I would encourage a no vote on it. I have some concerns about, I guess, where campaign money's coming from. And I think the money should be coming from inside the district that you're seeking to represent. And the PCR program has been an excellent program to encourage raising money from your constituents. And I guess I'm concerned that if you're getting your money from outside the district, which I think if this bill passed, you'd see the money coming in from outside of members' districts more so. And that's concerning to me. You end up serving two masters, so to speak. You've got the constituents who are voting for you, and you've got those that are funding your campaign. And in my view, they should be one and the same. It should be your constituents that you're thinking of. And this program focuses elected officials' attention on their constituent, or the program, the PCR program, focuses elected officials' attention on their constituents, and I don't think that we should eliminate that. I think we should be strengthening that, the connection between our elected officials and the people they're seeking to represent, their constituents.
Seeing no further discussion. Representative Rukavino,
well,
first.
I think Representative Eakin brings up a good point, and I'm just curious, Representative Druskowski, can you help me out? Does the new federal decision on corporate contributions in any way allow a Walmart or somebody to give individuals money now, and then this program slows down our own constituents being able to give us money?
Representative Druskowski.
Madam Chair, Representative Rukavina, we have Mr. Goldsmith here from the Campaign Finance Board. He may be able to better answer that.
Because, it compounds. Thank you, Madam Chair. It compounds the problem that Representative Eakin is talking about, where, big business or, big unions that you guys are trying to bust, which won't have any money after you do it, from giving us money, but yet you know, the money's going to be flowing. So, Mr. Goldberg, I think, could you?
Right. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Goldsmith. If you'd like to take a shot at Representative Rukavina's question.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
My name is Gary Goldsmith. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. The Citizens United case did not open up corporate contributions directly to candidates or party units. It permitted them only to make independent expenditures. However, there is other litigation pending, including litigation against Minnesota, which would make that further step possible. And we don't know how that litigation will come out, of course.
Thank you. Representative Rukavina.
Mr. Goldsmith, who's bringing a case against the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Madam Chair, Representative Rukavina, after the legislature in 2010 unanimously passed disclosure requirements that would provide some insight into the use of corporate money for independent expenditures, a lawsuit was commenced challenging those new requirements. Much of that has been dismissed, but there's still a challenge, and in addition, challenging the remaining prohibition on direct corporate contributions to candidates and party units. The plaintiffs in that lawsuit were two nonprofit corporations in Minnesota and one small for-profit corporation.
Thank you, Mr. Goldsmith. Seeing no additional Representative Wagenius.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Goldsmith. Would you just name what those corporations, those nonprofits?
Representative Wagenius, we can't hear you unless you talk to the microphone. I know it's awkward.
It's awkward.
That part in the table.
Thank you. I was just asking Madam Chair if he would be explicit and tell us what the names of those nonprofits and corporations were.
Mr. Goldsmith.
The nonprofits were the Taxpayers League of Minnesota and Minnesota Citizens Concerned for Life. The for-profit was a small travel services related company.
Thank you.
So, Madam Chair,
Representative Rukavina.
Madam Chair, you know, given that, people on both sides of the aisle should think about the fact that we are really restricting our citizens from having a voice in our election, spending, and yet cost the possibility of allowing nonprofits, a couple of whom mentioned were probably not going to be supporting me, and other corporations. I really think we should vote this bill down.
I renew my motion that House File 66 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. A roll call has been requested. Mr. Smith.
Representative Holberg.
Yes.
Representative Downey.
Aye.
Representative Carlson.
No.
Representative Abler.
Yes.
Representative Bruce Anderson.
Yes.
Representative Sarah Anderson.
Yes.
Representative Beard.
Aye.
Representative Breinert.
No.
Representative Biskins.
Yes.
Representative Champion.
No.
Representative Davids.
Yes.
Representative Eakin.
No.
Representative Garofalo.
Yes.
Representative Greiling.
No.
Representative Gunther.
Yes.
Representative Hackbarth.
No.
Representative Hamilton. Representative Hornstein.
No.
Representative Howes. Representative Huntley.
No.
Representative Kahn.
No.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Yes.
Representative Lanning.
Yes.
Representative Lincheski.
Yes.
Representative McNamara.
Yes.
Representative Nornitz.
Yes.
Representative Pulowski.
Yes.
Representative Rukavina.
No.
Representative Slawik.
No.
Representative Smith. Representative Wagenius.
No.
Representative Westrom.
Aye.
Representative Garofalo, you're up next. By a vote of 17 to 12, the motion prevails. The bill is on its way to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Druskowski. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll move House File 873 for passage and referral to the General Register.
Thank you. If you'd like to briefly explain your bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this bill is costs nothing and is opposed by nobody. I ask for your support.
And it's your re-election bill, too, right?
I campaigned on this, Madam Chair.
Yeah, I'm sure you did.
Oh, yeah.
Any questions on House File 873? Seeing none, Representative Garofalo, will you renew your motion?
I do, Madam Chair.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion's adopted. House File 874, Representative Garofalo.
Madam Chair, I move, move House File 874 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register.
Are there any questions on House File 874? Seeing none, Representative Garofalo, would you like to renew your motion?
So moved, Madam Chair.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion's adopted. Thank you very much, Representative Garofalo. Representative Downey. Welcome to the committee. Which bill would you like to do first?
I'd move House File 4 be passed and referred to the General Register, Madam Chair.
All right. Representative Downey moves House File 4 be considered by the committee. Excuse me. And then there's an A-12 amendment.
Yes, Madam Chair. I'd move the A-12 amendment.
And the purpose for the A-12 amendment?
Madam Chair, in the original bill, we required a 15% workforce reduction by the year 2015. In the state government finance omnibus bill, we put 12% of that reduction into this biennium and the remainder in the next biennium. So this amendment simply conforms House File 4 as a standalone bill to the state government finance omnibus bill.
All right. Thank you. Any questions on the A-12 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A-12 amendment say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Any questions on House File 4 as amended? It is contained in its entirety in the state government finance bill. Representative Plough.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Downey, can you translate 15% into numbers of public sector jobs that are going to be lost? Is it 50 or 100 or what would it be?
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Pawlowski. Well, first of all, the intention of the bill is to leverage existing retirements, attrition, and early retirement. So in terms of actual lost jobs, people losing their jobs, there is some flexibility given to the governor to do this the way he sees fit. But in terms of the number of positions that would no longer be in state government, I think it's probably easiest just to refer you to the very bottom line of the first page of the fiscal note, if you have that in front of you. It shows the actual reductions in the workforce on that bottom line. The aggregate by the end of fiscal year 13 is a reduction of 3,940. The aggregate by the end of fiscal year 15 is 4,925 positions.
So, Madam Chair.
Representative Plowski.
Madam Chair, Representative Downey, and that's what I was looking for. I can read that. I wanted it stated for the record. Can you estimate, given the 3,000-plus positions that are lost, the approximate savings to the state then?
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Plowski, again, I direct you to the first page of the fiscal note. In this biennium, the aggregate savings is $369 million. Once it's fully implemented, the annual savings becomes $348 million. So on a biennial basis, that would be $696 million per biennium.
Madam Chair.
Representative Plowski.
Madam Chair, Representative Downey, I appreciate you pointing me to the fiscal note. And what I want is this for the record, because this is the Ways and Means Committee, that we understand the totality of this bill, the number of positions lost, and the amount that either you want to say is saved or that will no longer exist in funding positions. Madam Chair, Representative Downey, just one other question, and you may not be able to answer this. I realize that both the House DFL caucus and the Republican caucus have stated repeatedly as a result of the elections that this is about jobs. Do we have, Madam Chair, or Representative Downey, a running total that, given what we're doing in this committee or in the House, how many jobs that we're cutting versus how many jobs that we're creating as a result of the so-called stimulus bills that are passing in this body? Madam Chair, do we have that?
Representative Plowski, I'm not aware of any such document.
Madam Chair, then this is mainly, I guess, for the majority party. It might be a very good idea, considering we're now in the end game, to begin to start a total of the number of positions that we know will be lost versus an estimate on the number of jobs that are going to be created.
It's in the summer.
That's just a question, a request, and I may be asking this question a few more times before session ends.
So noted.
Thank you, Representative Downing.
So noted. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Downey, when you're an advocate of a results-based budget or a zero-based budget, what you're looking for is the functions of government that are important to keep and the functions that are ones that you want to get rid of. And so I am looking at the DNR and PCA and Bowser areas, because those are the ones that on which the committees I sit, and tell me which functions in those areas that you are trying to get rid of.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Wagenius. We don't prescribe in House File 4 exactly where and the exact timing of these reductions, simply setting a target, and I would refer you to the finance bills in each of the respective committees to look for the particular priorities and the way their funding programs in those respective departments as compared to here in this bill. This bill sets the guideline. The individual committees have implemented the priorities to get there.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm surprised that you're abdicating your responsibility so quickly and saying that you have no responsibility. I look at the DNR bill, and I will give you an example. There were $6 million cut out of the general fund money for DNR waters, which means the DNR loses half of its hydrologists. Well, those are the folks that do things like check on dams to see if they're going to bust. And they do the FEMA applications for when we have flooding. So mainly those hydrologists are dealing with safety issues. So it is my assumption that if you're saying look at the how cuts were done in DNR and that you want additional cuts in DNR, that you want additional cuts in flood safety and additional cuts in the area of flooding, because that's where the money is. So is my assumption correct?
Representative Downey.
Madam Chair and Representative Wagenius, again, this bill sets an overall workforce reduction target, and the individual finance bills set the priorities and kind of implement the actual on-the-ground realization of those targets. So I'm not in a position to speak to the environment finance bill and whether or not you or I agree with those priorities. That would be the purview of the Environment Finance Committee and are not prescribed in House File 4.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, Madam Chair, we have not, I think you're saying to me, what I'm getting here, is you're saying, well, it is up to Representative McNamara to go back and say where these 15% cuts will come from. But that's not the way this bill is operating. This bill is just saying across the board and let the governor do it. So which is it? Is it Representative McNamara that's going to do it or the governor that's going to do it? Who's going to do it?
Representative Wagenius, this language, again, was included in the state government finance bill, and I know as the administration is working with both the House and Senate in discussions, we're having discussions around applying this, how it would work, making sure it's not double counted, et cetera. So the discussions around the implementation of this are happening on nearly a daily basis. So I don't know that Representative Downey has all the answers relative to exact positions or numbers or percentages in various agencies, but again, it would reflect in that we would keep workers in those highest priorities, and I don't think it's a blanket across the board application, if you will. So, Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. We are doing the public's work, and the public needs to know what is going on. It is not
we're not about the business of hiding from the public or covering up what we're doing. So I want to get on the record so the public knows what functions are going to be foregone, and I look in the area that I know the most about, but perhaps some of the other folks who know areas, for example, in health, what would be foregone there. We have gone down to the point of cuts that we're cutting safety. And I think the public needs to understand that that is what we're cutting. And I would understand you're not wanting us to discuss that in public, but I think it is necessary and proper.
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Madam Chair, just piggybacking on a comment that was made earlier, as we look at reducing the size and the scope of the state workforce and the expense of the state workforce, that we also look at how many jobs would be gained. I want to support my colleague from the other side of the aisle in asking the Office of Management and Budget to do a more dynamic analysis of legislation as we come forward and not a simple static analysis. So I do want to support the comments that were made earlier. As we look to reduce the regulations, the burdens, and the cost of government, how does that affect private sector job growth? That should be something that is brought forward by our state departments. Currently is not, and I would support that.
Thank you, Representative Biskins. Representative Abler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Downey, we actually haven't chatted much about this in the bill that we passed on the Health and Human Services omnibus. We took a 6% reduction to match what the governor had done. Can you explain the interaction of that with this?
Representative Downey.
Are these related at all? Is this a whole different bunch of people, or is this the same people you're talking about?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Downey.
Representative Abler, there should not be overlap or double counting, if that's your question. As we were setting budget targets, we kind of allocated out to each of the finance committees through their targets reductions that would kind of map back to this target. And then we did hold on to some of the cuts in the state government finance bill, and I might have to defer to Chair Lanning. I think there was maybe $90 million in the aggregate when you look at House File 4, the workforce reduction, the wage freeze, and the reduction of deputy commissioner positions. I believe we held on to some of it in state government finance, but otherwise it's all built into your targets.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Abler.
I think just to point out that indeed there was a lot of flexibility given to the committees, and I was trying to remember how we did that, because it was part of how the target got developed. And in the Human Service Committee, we decided to do some other things rather than have 15% fewer employees, or 12 or whatever number. We elected for 6 and then managed our money a different way. And so I think that was prudent, and the Senate did it 3 times the number that we have, so we have to discuss that in our conference committee. But just to the points that were raised, I think at least all I know is my niche. And we looked at our workforce and deemed that we should try to keep more than this number, and then we managed around that. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Huntley.
Madam Chair and Representative Downing, you said that you don't know what each one of these departments what's going to happen in them. So what you're saying is that you don't know what your bill does.
That's right.
And let me just point out that in the health department, They do inspections of restaurants to look at food safety. And a number of years ago, when Mike Osterholm was a state epidemiologist, he told the Health Human Services Committee that the number one reason that people get admitted to the hospital is because of food poisoning. And it's the Department of Health that does that. So what I'd like to know is, how many of those people are going to get laid off? So how much are restaurant inspections going to go down? It seems to me that it's part of your responsibility to know what the outcomes are when you have a bill.
Representative Huntley, again, these reductions will be reflect the priorities of the state. The governor and his staff have been working with our various fiscal chairs. I don't see anything in any of these bills that say we're going to cut food inspectors or the state workers that ensure the health and safety of the state are the first to go. Certainly that's not the case. So I think Representative Downey knows his bill. He knows what it does. And as we work through the conference committee process and in putting numbers to the various bills, we will work on the particulars of what this means in the various spending areas. And as you well know, as bills leave the House before they end up getting signed by the governor, there's an opportunity to have the dialogue to get something that we can all agree on. And I'm guessing that we can all agree that we need to keep food safety inspectors for the health of the state of Minnesota and its citizens. So, Representative Huntley, I don't know if you want to follow up, or Representative Downey, if you want to comment, but there's nowhere in here that says we're cutting the safety workers in the state of Minnesota.
Well,
Representative Huntley.
Madam Chair, then if we don't cut the food inspectors, are we going to cut the inspectors that look at the safety of nursing homes and the treatment that our parents get when they're in nursing homes to make sure that it's safe?
Madam Chair.
To this point?
Yes.
Representative Abler.
Well, and I was actually glad for the clarity that I got. I thought that's what we had done. Madam Chair, Representative Huntley, and whoever else is tracking this conversation. Anoka County is a delegated county. The Department of Health delegates to my county a lot of those local inspections, and then they provide us. I've learned that the hard way as I try to help some small businesses get open. And they're stuck by a lot of constraining rules, and so I think that's a lot of that's a county focus, and the department oversees it. In terms of what Minnesota's going to do, we were given the target, and the bill that we both voted for followed the governor's recommendation on 6%. And so whatever, we're at the governor's level, so there's no new reduction in human health inspections because of this bill going forward in our, should we take the House position. The Senate does quite a different approach. But so I'm comfortable about that for today, if that helps you though.
Representative Rukavina.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My good friend, Representative Downey, did you grab 15% out of the air, or is there some logic behind your choice, or where did you get that actual percentage?
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Rukavina. It's a combination of things. There have been a number of consulting studies done over the years in Minnesota, going all the way back to the Drive to Excellence, very recently a study done by Excipio in the area of information technology. And they all pointed to roughly a 15 to 20% employee efficiency opportunity if we would consolidate and do things differently. So, Representative Rukavina, I would say overall looking at the state workforce over the last decade, the last 3 years, not having changed at all, private sector organizations realizing substantial productivity gains in these types of operations, and then those studies that I mentioned, I think 15% is a pretty accurate number. And it was validated and vetted as part of our budget targeting setting process. So I think the validation from the fiscal chair is coming back and saying that we can make this happen within our own overall budget target here in the House confirm that.
Well,
Representative Rubin.
Madam Chair and members, I'm puzzled as to how, as an example, your most important bill of the session, I remember you touting it to all of you, Republicans, was House File 1. Mandating, if I'm not mistaken, was it 120 or 150 day review process for permitting businesses in Minnesota to the PCA and the DNR? Representative Wagini has helped me out. Was it 150 days? I can't remember. So how do you expect that to happen when you're cutting all those departments? You know, members, when I was driving home late Thursday, I talked to this mother for over I'll bet you 45 minutes about her middle-aged, mentally ill son who she finally got into a treatment program. She's probably in her mid-70s. I know the lady personally. and what she had to go through to coordinate between Hennepin and St. Louis County, because the rules and regulations that Representative Apler and Huntley know much better than me. You know, these are the people that are going to be affected. Snowplow, you know, today I hit a hole in the middle of the freeway. My teeth are still up in my nasal cavity from chattering so hard. And, you know, those public employees are out there in the middle of the road putting tar, trying to do things, and there's going to be less money for them. And Representative Downey, I don't know how you can justify this bill and blame the, you know, 3,000-some employees that probably have had way more work put on them in the last 3 years because of Representative Carlson started the cutting process in 2008 with, what was it, House File 18?
1812.
12, Mr. Chair, over there, thank you. And so, you know, we blame public employees for the condition that the state is in when they had nothing to do with it other than providing their hard work, and Representative Huntley hit the nail on the head when you talk about nursing home activities in our Department of Health and how it's going to be affected. But to get back to Representative Abler's question, Representative Downey, you know, Minskew's already got a $400 million, I believe, and the U cut in the bill with the OHE. We've been cutting all these departments over the last 3 years. Why do you start at a date of July 1st of 2011? We've been cutting for years. I don't know what the actual number is, but I know a testimony in higher education places, Representative Breiner, I think Matt Cato, talking about 80-some people being laid off. Why are they going to be counted already if they're in the mix of being laid off, even though it didn't happen on July 1? If it happened on June 30th, that because of teacher contracts or AFSCME contracts or whatever, these people are going down the road, and going to cause a lot of backup in financial aids for our students and our veterans coming home and everything else. Why isn't that figured into the mix? And how do you justify, Representative Downey, a bill like House File 1, touted as the most important bill of the session, creating jobs, mandating permitting in 150 days? You know, I don't know off the top of my head what 365 times 6 is for Polymet, but it's been way more than 150 days, and I don't understand how you can do this with the cuts that you're mandating. Nothing's going to...
Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of things. You made a number of points, Representative Rukavina. I'll try to remember all of them. First of all, Minnesota State Colleges and Universities are not included in this bill. I specifically excluded them from the definition of executive branch agencies for the purposes of this bill. And actually, I think the Minskew system already has done a pretty good job getting a handle on their cost of labor and their workforce issues at a time of extreme growth in the number of people attending. With regard to the date of January 1st, 2011, frankly, originally it was July 1st to start with the biennium, but in order to do the math and calculate the fiscal note and things, we needed to have a firm number in terms of number of employees. So we went back to January 1st, and frankly, that makes achieving the target a little bit easier, as well as there is attrition and early retirements through Representative Carlson's bill already occurring here in the first 6 months of this year. And then I want to get back to maybe your broader point, and you know, I don't think anybody's blaming anybody here. And in fact, I think when you look at this bill and a number of the other provisions that I think empower our state workforce, my observation of our state workforce is there's no reason we can't in state government achieve the same kind of productivity gains that workers in the private sector have achieved. There is nothing about a state worker that differs from a private worker. These are gains that we can accomplish to put our state on a solid fiscal footing, a structurally sustainable footing in terms of our cost structure. And if we give them the tools and the capabilities that are reflected in all of the broad fiscal bills and omnibus policy bills that are passing, there's no reason we can't achieve these kind of productivity gains in the public sector as well.
Representative Kahn. I'm sorry, Representative
Rivera. Representative Downey, you're not addressing the fact that we've been cutting for 3 years, and prior to that we cut for another 4 or 5 years. So we had 1 year there where we appropriated some money in 2007, but there's been cut after cut after cut. And frankly, Representative Donnie, can you tell me how many employees are at the Minnesota State College and University system?
Representative Downey, that might be a Representative Norris question.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I do have some numbers here about state government. You mentioned that we've been cutting, and yet if you look at our FTE count by fiscal year, go back to 2007, 2006, it was 31,002, 2007, 31,008, 2008, it was 32,400, 2009, 32,500, and 2010, 32,700. So we keep talking about cut, and it's just not reflected. I'm talking right out of the workforce report in 2010. And if you look at the total compensation costs in these executive branch agencies that are the subject of this bill, in 2007, the total compensation cost went up 4.1%. In 2008, the total compensation cost went up 7.28%. In 2009, the total compensation cost went up 4.84%. And last year, total compensation cost went up 1.03%. So I know we keep hearing about cuts, and I think we're somewhat victimized by the definition of a cut in state government being the reduction in the base appropriation, but we've still been experiencing increases, and that is also true in the state workforce, which in my mind simply says we have an opportunity here, and if we equip our people with the tools and we align their incentives and their compensation to joining with the legislature and the governor to accomplish the big change that we need in state government, I think we can accomplish that. With regard to the MinSCU system, I believe there's just a little north of 60,000 total employees in the MinSCU system, and I believe you might actually have seen a very, very small reduction in the workforce in the MinSCU system, which is why I did not include them in this bill. They're already, I think, working effectively towards these goals.
Well, Madam Chair.
Representative Rukavina, and I've got Reinhart, Lanning, Wagini.
I'm surrendering.
And we're going to recess at 11:30, whether we're done or not.
I surrender after this last comment.
Okay? All right.
Because if you want to talk about that minimal amount of increase that you mentioned during those years, you know, I got my 50 richest people here in Minnesota. Now it's I got a comparison. You're 59 people in 2006, the wealthiest. 59 people had a collective income of $2.481 billion. And in 2011, Representative Hornstein can document it, the 59 richest, the same number, $3.43 billion. A billion-dollar increase in 5 years of the 59 richest. And you're unwilling to touch them, Representative Downey, to share in the sacrifice of this balancing, this budget act, and these financial, terribly financial times, but you're going to go after 3,000-some state workers, plus state workers, and in the process, you know, cut the time that it takes to help our constituents wade through bureaucracy in the first place.
Well, Representative Rukavina, you're on the tax committee with $1 billion growth in wealth. How much more taxes are they paying off of that to the state?
Nothing, because their income taxes have been cut since 2001 to help pay for Representative Downey's Edina getting more state money. We haven't even got into that. We'll save that for
the
floor.
That would surprise me.
I'm trying to be joyful, Madam Chair.
I know.
Representative Kahn, not to get upset.
Well, Madam Chairman and Representative Downey, it looks as if you have protected one of the worst things that we've seen with early retirement incentives, which is the cost to the pension plan. But when you put, is there any estimate when you put all of these things together, how much money will actually be saved when the funds are then redirected to the pension plan?
Representative Downey.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. When you say, if I could, Representative Kahn, to clarify, when you say put all these things together, are you talking about just what's in my bill or other?
Just your bill. Looking at this bill. With the early, one of the worst things that has happened about early retirement incentives, and we've also told about how wonderful these are as cost-saving measures because you replace highly paid people with people who are starting at a lower level on the salary scale. But one of the problems has been is that the cost has always then been borne by the pension plan. Well, you're covering the cost to the pension plan, but we haven't had so do you have an estimate as to how those numbers balance off each other after you've paid the pension plan, as you do it in this bill? What, how much then do you save from the early retirement?
Representative Downey.
Because you have a new person, you know, allegedly, if you need to fill that position, if it's an essential position, you need to fill it. You have a new person coming in, plus you're making the pension payments from the older person. You're making the cost of the plan.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I can answer that. I'm not sure if it'll be to your satisfaction or not. The net impact of the savings less the expenditures on the early retirement side, the pension impact is netted out in the total cost savings line to the state on the first page of the fiscal note. So it's $114 million in fiscal year 12, $254 million in fiscal year 13, so that's a total of $369 million, and that is net of the monies, the first dollar saved, which is paid back to the pension. So I'm not sure if that gets at the entirety of your question, but that's the aggregate.
Then,
Representative Kahn.
Well, one of the things that's also bothered me about these general across-the-board cut bills is that we don't seem to preserve anything that we might consider our essential positions in the state. For example, one of the things, because the 35W bridge was half, at least in my district, one of the things that we distinctly saw was, even without cutting positions, we saw that there were problems in bridge inspections. And when that bridge went down, we then had, there were all kinds of reports saying that we needed accelerated bridge inspections, that there were other bridges built at about that time that might have a similar problem. How does this bill preserve any of those kinds of things, and how does it work when a problem, you know, obviously bridge inspections was brought to the front of the line in terms of, you know, after a bridge fell down. But how does that figure in with your reemployment prohibition, which in case some of the people that are, that we've gotten rid of, who cannot be reemployed with the state or can't even enter a contract with the state as a consultant, and it might turn out that they were someone that was just critical for an issue that we didn't realize until something happened, like a bridge falling down.
Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Kahn, I would direct you to a couple of elements in the fiscal note on page 3 of 14. The department, this is a fiscal note that I just got today, so I haven't had a chance to have discussions with the department, but it looks like they're pushing back pretty strongly, frankly, against the provision in the bill prohibiting rehiring. You'll notice, number one, that they say 35% of the FTE reductions would be achieved via layoffs, and they're paying for the costs of those severances. And then 40% of the FTE reductions would be achieved through attrition. I think the original intent of our bill is that it would be much more highly oriented towards attrition than layoff. We have almost the entire number of workers here retiring and leaving through attrition over the four-year period. But anyway, the department says this is more intentionally or more intelligently designed, and they actually talk about rehiring 4 out of the 5 people that are lost through attrition. Again, that, I'll say, kind of violates the letter of the bill here, but clearly they're pushing back. And part of the reason for doing that, as you can see on the top of page 4, is that they're saying that the state must continue to provide essential services. So I appreciate that they have actually taken a lot of time to think through this, realize the 15% workforce reduction in a really smart way without compromising the essential services. And while we might have to have some give and take here moving forward as we go through the state government finance conference committee process with the administration, it appears that they've sent some strong signals back to us that they feel like they can make it. We can see see these kinds of savings and yet not compromise in their mind the essential services and balance the workforce intelligently from their perspective. So I think we've got enough common ground to continue working here.
So, Representative Kahn.
Apparently, and obviously I've just seen the fiscal note too, but apparently they're saying that this this language would have, this hiring freeze language would have to be modified in some case, that the, in some cases, that because there are a set people, you know, they just said, even just looking at the bill as is, the position I said was that something might happen after the bill was passed that would show us that it wasn't, that it wasn't a good idea. I guess I just think that making decisions on employment based on what individuals, on the employment needs of the state as a whole, based upon what additional, what people want to do or what position in life they're in, just doesn't seem to me like a very intelligent way of structuring things.
Representative Beard.
No, Madam Chair, I think I'll pass. Thanks.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, House File 4 is all about setting a target. I think we all recognize the importance of targets as we try to resolve our budget issues. And that's what this bill does. It sets a target. And I don't think we would want, in a bill like this, to specify all the ways in which you're going to achieve that target any more than any of us on any finance committee would want ways and means to be specifically telling us how are you going to meet your target. We're given a target in a finance committee by ways and means, and we are then charged with the responsibility of figuring out how to meet that target. And so we need to keep that in mind with regard to this. And the other thing that apparently some people are still confused about here is that the language, the amendment we adopted here, changes the date back to January 1. And so any reductions that have occurred since January 1 would count towards this target. And the other thing that you need to understand is that we're not talking about 12% in the first year, 15% over the second year, on top of everything else that the finance committees have already proposed with their bills. What Human Services did, what any other finance committee did, counts towards achieving this target. And we're not talking about adding on another 12 to 15%. Now, obviously, that begs a question about the possibility of double counting. And we have to be mindful of that and careful with that. But that's not going to be an easy thing to sort out, to what extent there maybe is any double counting here. What we're doing with this bill is we're setting the target. We're indicating that the work that the finance committees have been doing counts towards that target. And then we're turning over to the administration the details here. Let them do the managing, not have us do the micromanaging, as where best to finish meeting that target. And I think that's consistent with good management practice. And the last thing I want to say is that the workers of this state are not the problem. Members, the problem is our deficit. The problem is the deficit. And we've got a big deficit to solve, and this is one way in which we can help solve that problem.
Thank you, Representative Lanning. On that note, we are going to recess.
Well, can I just say
your first word
on that? No, I want
very briefly.
Just very briefly. Representative Lanning's talk is fine, except that doesn't correspond to the language in the bill. The language in the bill says shall, must, may not, etc. It doesn't say this is a target that we want to achieve. So your speech is fine, but it would be nice if it applied to the bill.
Thank you, Representative Kahn, for those closing remarks. We will be in recess to the call of the chair. Members, if you will please take your materials for House File 4 and House File 1, 2, 3, 4, put them back in your folder. We will go back to those this evening, in addition to the other bills still on the agenda. The earliest we will reconvene is 6 p.m., but it could be far later than that. I'll try and make an announcement on the House floor. I'm going to reconvene the Ways and Means committee hearing when we left off. Representative Downey was presenting House floor. It had been amended by the A-12 amendment, and I had a number of members that wanted to make comment. Representative Breinhart, you're up next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You don't expect me to remember that far back, do you?
No. Well, I have the list and wrote that down. So
no, I actually have some idea of what I wanted to say, but it's sort of humorous, you know, just to try to take up where we left off. But I'll do my best, and I'll be quick.
All right. Thank you. Representative Breinhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Downey, my comment relates primarily to something that Representative Biskins mentioned about in the potential that there might be, in the future, there might be the potential for the our agencies to take a dynamic picture of the job environment, and that they might include jobs created in the private sector when they look at this sort of list. And my only point, or this sort of proposal, my only point was that the data goes in both directions, that, you know, I'm looking right here at data from the Economic Policy Institute that actually shows for every private sector, for every 100 private sector jobs lost, about 30, or public sector jobs, about 30 private sector jobs are lost. So I know there's data on both sides of that, and but if you think about some comments that our own state economist, Tom Stinson, has made in that direction, he has indicated this level of cuts would hurt the private sector economy. So my only point was the data, the dynamic picture that Representative Biskins might be referring to could be dynamic in either direction in terms of its effect on the private sector economy.
Thank you, Representative Breinhart. Representative Kahn.
Thank you.
Representative Breinhart is much better than I am. I don't have I don't have the faintest idea of what I was going to say. So obviously just as well.
All right, and the other two members were Representative Wagenius and Eakin. And so they're sure working their back to committees. Anybody else have questions on House File 4 as amended? All right. And
Madam Chair, if I may make a quick comment.
Certainly.
We talked a little bit about the number of state employees and minister employees this morning, and so in checking on that today, found that the total is not 60,000. Which was what the author testified this morning, but it's miscounts everybody, 15,671. Just to kind of put it in context of the number of employees who work for Minsku.
Representative Downey.
Madam Chair, I was referring to statistics off of the Department of Employment and Economic Development website that splits out state-level education, and I'm pretty certain that the executive branch agencies plus higher ed is right about 100,000 employees, so we may just need to compare our statistical sources, Representative Carlson.
Representative Carlson.
The numbers that I just shared come from Minsku. Now you mentioned higher ed. Are you including the university when you were saying 60,000 this morning? I didn't check on that number, but I know that at one time the university had more employees when you took in the hospital and all of the other various entities in the university than Minsku did. But even with that, it wouldn't approach 60,000, let alone 100. You better double-check your source, Madam Chair, and I'll do as well, but these are numbers from Minsku.
Representative Wagenius, you were on the list earlier today when we recessed, and I want to make sure you were able to ask your question of Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I go back to looking at what we don't know, and what we don't know is the outcomes for Minnesota. And I think just listening to you, I glean one thing, and that is that you think we should be more up to date on computer systems and we should be more efficient that way. And I would agree with that. I think that's a huge issue. But when I look at a lot of things that state workers do, computer's not going to help. It is not going to help going into the restaurant and checking if there's food poisoning there. It's not going to be able to go in and inspect that dam. It's not a bridge inspector. So while they can do their paperwork better, and I think we probably get perhaps better results, computers aren't going to walk across that bridge or into that restaurant or over that dam. So I still can't then understand the outcomes Minnesotans are getting from this bill. And I think that's what we're paid the big bucks to do, is to determine what outcomes we want for Minnesotans. And I just can't figure it out with your bill. Can you help?
Representative Downey.
Madam Chair, Representative Wagenius, I don't know if I can help. We've talked about this a few times where I think you really need to look at the individual finance bills to see what the functional and programmatic implications are of realizing these kinds of savings. You know, I think an overriding comment is that we're talking about positions and not functions or outcomes, and I think the hope is that we'd be able to accomplish good outcomes for the number of people that we would have in the executive branch agencies 4 years from now. And if we do it right and intelligently and realize some productivity gains, I think the hope is that we'd be as functional and achieve the outcomes that we're all looking for. But I think the real answer in your case, in terms of some of the areas you've mentioned, are perhaps in the environment finance bill or other finance bills, not here.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think you have defined the problem I'm having. They aren't in those other bills. We don't know from those other bills what the outcomes would be. If we did, we would be able to say, well, Minnesotans, we're not going to have so many dam inspections. We're just not going to do so much of that this year. And you're saying if we do it right and intelligently, and that's what we should be doing in this committee. It's not a matter of hoping things are getting better. It's our doing our homework and figuring out what outcomes Minnesotans get. I mean, if we can't do this, then I don't even think it's worth talking about zero-based budgeting, because that's even harder than doing outcomes-based budgeting. So I am just frustrated as anything, because I can't go back and tell my constituents, this is what we planned for you, and these are the outcomes we want for you, because I have no idea what they are. And from what I hear, you don't either.
Madam Chair, I just want to point out that we did hear all of the finance bills in this committee, so I don't know. I can't answer. I can say the same answer again, but the answer isn't in this bill. It's in the Finance Committee's absorption of these targets in their bills.
Representative Wagenius.
Follow-up. No, the finance bills wouldn't tell us, because I know that there is not enough cut in DNR to make the cuts that you are doing in this bill. So you're cutting beyond what's in the individual finance bills, and that's where we can't see the outcomes. That's the problem.
Representative Eakin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Downey, I just had a couple of questions. I think we need to, you know, put things into context when it comes to what kind of level we're talking about as far as cutting. And I was wondering if you could tell me, you know, where we rank with other states in terms of the number of public employees compared to the number of private employees with other states? Are we one of the leaner states in the country? Because what I had heard was that it was somewhere around 10th or something in the nation that we rank in terms of the number of public employees compared with private employees. Would that be correct?
Representative Downey.
Madam Chair, I'm aware of only one statistic, and it's from the census, and they attempted to take a snapshot of a certain month. I believe it was in the month of March of 2010, and they include utility employees and wastewater employees and all different kinds of categories of employees. And so, number one, if you want to look at employment and really compare it, you got to look at something that's seasonally adjusted. Seasonal employment levels are very different in Minnesota than Florida or Texas or Arizona or other states. And then it's really hard to tell whether we're comparing apples to apples in those. So I've based this less on a statistic that supposedly compares states and much more on our actual experience in Minnesota, which is the cost of labor in these executive branch agencies has gone up every year, each of the last 4 years. The number of employees, while not a huge increase, has actually crept up. So I think we look at that as an opportunity, and that's the basis for this bill, not saying we're better or worse than other states.
Okay. Well, and Madam Chair,
Representative Eakin.
And Representative Downey, and I, and like I said, I had heard that we're one of the leaner ones in comparison to other states as far as our public employee numbers. And but as far as the issue that you raised about the growth in the public sector, and it sounds like it was rather modest growth, does it reflect simply the increasing population in the state? Is the population growing faster than the rate of public employment?
Representative Downey.
Madam Chair, I'd say they're probably roughly comparable in the last 4 years.
Okay, and Madam Chair, and Representative Downey, as far as the number of private employment as well, I would guess that would probably be increasing even during times of recession. What that means is that the employment is not growing as fast as it should be, but I would guess that was growing as well, and that probably at least just to reflect the increasing population levels in the state.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure if I totally understood your question, but actually the private sector, if you take out healthcare, education, and government employment, the private sector is off massively in Minnesota, literally declines from 10% to 35% over the last 3 years during this recession. So I may not have understood your question, but I think the part of the basis for this bill, frankly, is I think the public observation that what has been experienced up and down their block and in their own homes is very, very different than what they see at the state, and the thought that the state would somehow be the only place that we don't find those productivity gains or share in any of that economic hardship, that's another basis for the bill.
Okay, and Madam Chair and Representative Downey, so maybe, and I'm asking this sincerely because I want to understand if even during a time of recession, I thought that there's still some increase in employment. It's just that the population levels and so on are increasing faster, and that and so, you know, we have a higher unemployment rate. But it's just that not as many jobs are being created, not enough jobs are being created to keep the rate down. Is that, I don't know if that would be correct or not,
Representative Downey.
Madam Chair, I don't have the statistics in front of me, Representative Eakin, to tell you for sure. But boy, my recollection was that we shed about 200,000 jobs net in Minnesota during the recession. I could be wrong. I don't want to be held to that. But it's definitely down as a raw number.
Okay.
Significantly.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And your charge to us to look at the finance bills reminded me that in transportation we really don't have general fund money supporting these positions in MnDOT. I think Representative Beard pointed that out on the House floor, that MnDOT is funded primarily through, you know, Trunk Highway and other dedicated funds. And so in the case of the finance area that I'm most familiar with, there's really no general fund savings to what you're doing. It's just kind of cutting positions, you know, almost for the sake of cutting positions. And so, you know, it ends up being 165 snowplow drivers, patchers, people involved in vegetation control. And as Representative Wagenius has pointed out, there are very real and concerning outcomes. And I think it's doubly concerning because there's not even a general fund advantage to what you're doing, at least in the transportation area. So I just wanted to point that out. I don't know if you wanted to comment on that, Representative Downey, but, you know, as you reminded me of, to look at the finance bills, we have a couple of positions, Representative Beard, that I think are going to be lost in the passenger rail office in the House bill, but certainly, you know, 15% would be a pretty big hit to MnDOT, which is an agency that's already been cut pretty significantly over the last 8 to 10 years. So, you know, no general fund advantage to this in transportation.
Thank you. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, when I look at this, there's always this balance between you have a large policy decision, and then you give some structure to that, which the finance committees did. But, you know, to micromanage to the point where you dictate to the agencies very smaller kinds of decisions, I mean, there is flexibility that this executive branch needs to have in order to be able to manage appropriately their areas. So concern I have is striking the balance here between the large goal, the finance committees, but I just think we really have to allow the agencies to be able to manage some of these things to the best of their ability within these parameters. And I think there's really quite a bit of detail here already and in the finance committees to the point where I think we really are best left some of these other details to the actual agencies themselves to manage that.
Thank you. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I do have a couple of questions. When I came in and asked about the number of employees, I thought it sounded like almost you were coming to a vote, and I was just coming up from taxes. So I did have, from this morning, though, a couple of questions and comments. Some of you may recall that the state economist, when we're talking about these layoffs and what have you, has pointed out that a job is a job. And I think we have to keep that in mind. The other point that I would make is that, or a question that I would ask, the first of a couple, three, have you taken a look at what the impact of this would be on some of our communities? And I'm thinking mainly of some of the regional centers. You know, for example, Bemidji, Brainerd, you know, where you have a large number of public employees, and what that would mean in those communities in terms of their unemployment rate and what the long-term impact of something like this would be. Have you looked at, in other words, the regional centers? You know, Bemidji has a DNR office to begin with and several other public entities, and your bill doesn't impact on Minsku, as I understand it, so Bemidji State University wouldn't be impacted. Brainerd is the same way, major DNR office, and those are smaller, mid-sized communities, and the ability to absorb these cuts and what that might mean is what I'm asking if you've taken a look at.
Representative Downey.
Madam Chair, we didn't try to prescribe either by department or by geography where these cuts would occur. Our intent was that the individual fiscal committees and the agencies and the executive branch would do this in a strategic and intelligent way relative to impacting the unemployment rates of a given region. I think these executive branch agencies, even though they're 32,000 people, and this is a biennial savings of close to $700 million eventually, you know, when you consider local governments, K-12 education, healthcare, the federal government, post office, all the other units of government, I don't know that we are affecting employment unemployment in a material way, and I'd be surprised if these were deployed in such a way that it would materially affect the unemployment rate in a given region of the state. But that's just an observation, not based on a scientific, you know, application of some kind of a model.
I think, Madam Chair, Representative Downey, you ought to take a look at that, because we do have
various regions of the state where you do have a concentration of public employees, and they would be impacted, and the ability of some of those smaller mid-sized communities to absorb that increased unemployment could have a major impact. I think it's something that you should take a look at as this bill moves forward. But, Madam Chair, I did want to go to the question that I had a discussion with the author on the House floor dealing with the early retirement incentive and the hiring freeze, and I pointed out what I thought were a couple of problems as a result of my work on this same issue, mainly with the former commissioner of MMB, on what the impact and his and when we the conversation we had, he was using his own department as an example and the various skill levels that he would need if he had had a large number of people or even a small number if they were in significant positions, and the ability to hire from the outside if needed. And you indicated you would take a look at that language, and this is the same language that we had before us on the House floor. So that would be one thing that I'd like you to comment on, what the current status of your taking a look at it is, because it was a management issue from his perspective, and he and I worked on this issue for a couple of years, or at least a year. The other one, the re-employment section that you have with the early retirement, what would be the impact, for example, in the area of education with the state academies, their public employees under the Department of Education? And if somebody opted for early retirement, you generally need people to teach in certain skill areas. You also have the need for substitutes, and what sometimes happens is that a retired teacher will be called upon, sometimes without even their request, if they're in a high-demand field, if they're willing to come in and substitute. And that can be short-term, it can be longer-term, depending on what the need is. And it would appear to me then that with Section 6 and 7 dealing with the early retirement, your restrictive language is creating some unnecessary management problems within at least one state agency in that instance, and maybe in all the state agencies if they need a skilled employee that doesn't happen to be available internally.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Carlson. I'd reiterate my interest in having discussions with the administration on that very topic. However, the administration was not, up until perhaps even recently, interested in negotiating on the provisions in our various bills, so that conversation isn't as far along as any of us might like. I think if you look at the fiscal note that we got just today, it does show pretty clearly that they're, I'll say, kind of rejecting the hiring freeze and some of these reemployment provisions and appear to be able to actually hit the 15% objective even while doing that. So, again, I'm open to that discussion. It might be the exact right thing to balance employment properly and still hit the target, but without the benefit of any conversations with these folks and only looking at the fiscal note, it's hard to say for sure where we'd end up.
Representative Carlson.
Madam Chair, in our discussion on the House floor, that wasn't the impression you left me with, that you were going to negotiate those provisions with the administration. The comment that you made was that you were going to take a look at that language. So I had a different impression from your response on the House floor, and that's why I say the language is still before us. That's a totally different question if you're talking about negotiating it versus you as the author of the bill taking a look at what I thought you felt after our discussion on the floor might be a problem, considering the history of those discussions last session on early retirement. But I'll stop there. Apparently, it's a little different scenario than what you shared with me on the House floor. Thank you.
All right, Representative Downey, seeing no other questions, if you'd like to renew your motion.
Yeah, Madam Chair, just move House File 4, be approved to pass, and sent to the General Register.
As amended.
As amended, thank you.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay?
No.
No.
Motion's adopted. Representative Garofalo, if you'd like to move your... I'm sorry. I'm looking at an old agenda here. Representative Downey, if you'd like to move your next bill, House File 1, 2, 3, 4, for consideration by the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To move House File 1, 2, 3, 4, be passed and referred to the General Register.
All right. And I'm not aware of any amendments to this particular bill. Is that correct?
Correct, Madam Chair.
All right. If you'll explain the bill briefly to the committee, please.
Sure, Madam Chair. There's a an approach to reducing the cost of procurements in large organizations, which is kind of an end-to-end evaluation of what we're doing in terms of locating contractors to provide goods and services, the way and the manner that we procure those goods and services, and then the way we actually pay for them. I'm happy to answer questions about the details, but bottom line, this is a very large area of spending in state government, probably about $2 billion when you look at just commodity purchases, upwards to close to $4 billion when you add other services and contracts. And so there's a real opportunity here, perhaps even a 5, in some organizations, even a 10% savings opportunity. So this simply requires the Department of Administration to issue an RFP to bring in an outside party to identify whether there is a significant opportunity here or not.
Thank you. Representative Downey, are there any questions? Seeing no amendments and no questions, if you'd like to renew your motion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd renew my motion to have House File 1234 pass and be referred to the General Register.
All right. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion adopted.
No.
No.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm tired. Let's do this again. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay.
No.
No.
The motion passes. Thank you. Okay, the next bill on our agenda is House File 632, Representative House.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move House File 632 be recommended to pass and go to the General Register.
Thank you, Representative House. If you have to briefly explain your bill to the committee, please.
Madam Chair and members, there was a little confusion before between your committee administrator and myself. I gave him an amendment on Friday. He claims I didn't, but I think in the rush of Friday and the abscess tooth I had, he might be right, but I swear I gave it to him. I'm going to offer it orally if it's okay with the chair and the committee. It's simply deleting Section 1 of the bill. Representative Mahoney and Representative Lemire voted for the bill in Jobs and Economic Development Committee, but wanted Section 1 to be eliminated.
And Representative House, I don't have a problem with that being done in committee. Representative Carlson, are you okay with having the oral amendment to delete Section 1 to get the bill in the shape the author would like to discuss it?
Do I have any opposition?
Yeah,
that?
I mean, it
no.
Did meet the deadline, but I just wanted...
Oh, the deadline question, that's fine.
Thank you.
Okay. I just hope that at some point, if we're in that situation, we get the same accommodation.
Madam Chair and members, to make it quick and easy, what this does is create a new license for plumbing. It's called a maintenance plumber's license. So the main reason we brought this forward was for resorts, hotels, motels that could have a janitor that could also be a maintenance plumber, i.e. repair a broken toilet, fix a leaky faucet, change a faucet, etc. And with a great deal of discussion with Representative Mahoney, Representative Lemire, and Deed and Dolly, we determined that a maintenance plumber would fit that description. The bill describes how they would supervise a maintenance plumber, and the reason it's in Ways and Means is because there is a fee, $40 a year for that license, because we are creating a new license. I'll stand for any questions, but that's the whole gist of the bill. We are creating a new license that will make it easier for people that own a resort or own a building
to do general maintenance of the plumbing nature without a master plumber.
All right, thanks. First, let's vote on the oral amendment to delete Section 1 of the bill.
Sorry.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion's adopted. Now, members, are there any questions of the bill as presented? Representative Nornes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just curious, I guess, Representative Howes, there will be a test. How do they become the qualified? How do they get the license?
Representative Howes.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Nornes, right now the Department of Economic Deed is working on a specific test. They do not have it finalized yet, but it would probably be a sit-down conversation with at least 10 questions. What kind of experience do you have? Have you changed a toilet, changed a faucet, fixed a leaky pipe? How did you do it? What did you use? Those kinds of things. It won't be a test the same as a master plumber. And I am putting a great deal of faith in Deed that they will, or I mean Dolly, that they will do this in that fashion.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I would qualify. I've done all of those things.
Most of us have. And I might add that this maintenance plumber can only work on something they own or the person that they work for directly owns. They can't do anything outside of that scope.
Thank you. Are there any additional questions on House File 632 as amended? Seeing none, Representative Howes, if you'd like to renew your motion.
I would like to renew my motion that House File 632 as amended be sent to the General Register.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion passes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Howes, we hope you're feeling better soon. Representative Kiffmeyer. Welcome to the committee. Representative Kiffmeyer, if you'd like to move Senate File 509, and then we will insert the House language to get the bill in the shape that you would like to discuss it.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I do move Senate File 509.
All right. And then the next thing we need you to do is move the language of House File 210, the fourth engrossment, to amend it onto Senate File 509.
Madam Chair, that is correct.
All right. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion's adopted. Okay. Now, there's a number of amendments here to the bill. Do you want to take those first to get
the
bill?
Yes, Madam Chair.
All right. And if we want to start with the A38 amendment.
That's correct, Madam Chair. I move House File 210 A38 amendment.
And if you'd like to explain the amendment to the committee.
Madam Chair, this page 18, delete section 25. This is an area that is covered in other ways. And page 18, oops, went to page 25. Page 18.
Well, members, I think this deletes a penalty in the bill for election day behavior. For unlawful voting, it's requesting a provisional ballot or one that be counted. We're removing that as a new penalty, so there aren't any new penalties in the bill.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
All right. Any questions on the A38 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Amendment is adopted.
Okay, and then, Madam Chair, I would like to move my next amendment. The A45 amendment.
All right, and members, there's a number of, there's also an A39 amendment in the packet that was put in last Thursday or Friday. You can see from the time date stamp on that. So the elements of that amendment are also included in the A45 amendment. And as we went through the new fiscal note and looked at the bill, there are other components to the A45 amendment. As you can obviously see, it didn't make the 5 o'clock rule for the day before. We do have, or as soon as practicable. As you can see, this was done very late today, but it involves kind of a removing of the money around so that you'd have, we reduce the amount of money going to the education campaign, but set up a base level funding for some of the duties of Department of Public Safety around the voter ID card, and then there's some technical changes to this. So I'm hoping that the committee will, it's my intent to move this unless there's just major big-time heartburn about it. It's mostly technical in nature and balancing money around. So do you want to just briefly go through the components of the amendment?
Madam Chair, yes, I can. First one is on line 1214, deleting by law, just again a technical issue recommended by staff. Second one also, line 16, is another technical recommended by staff. Line 17 on page 12, the actual cost of providing voter identification cards not to exceed, again, just clarifies that language. Page 12, delete line 18. That's just part of the beginning of the of that amendment on line 17. Same with line 19. Just makes it flow better and clarifies. On page 12, line 20, after the period, again clarifies that on June 30th, each odd-numbered year, any balance is transferred to the general fund. On page 23, line 5, inserting the amount $2,200,000. Page 3, line 7, after the period insert, it's a one-time appropriation. Again, on page 23, line 10, after the second, the, insert Commissioner of Management and Budget for transfer to the. Again, clarifying and just making clear the responsibilities and the language. And again, on page 23, line 13, insert the base for this appropriation is $215,000 in fiscal year 2014 and each year thereafter. So, Madam Chair, that is the sum of the amendment.
All right, members, pretty technical in nature. Are there any questions? Representative Slawick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just trying to figure out the one on line 10, or let's see, no, 1.12 in the amendment where we're putting the Commissioner of Management and Budget for the transfer to the. I'm trying to see how that reads.
Are you on line? Are you on page 12 then?
Representative Kiffmeyer, it's on page 23, okay. Line 10. I believe it's line 12 of the amendment. Is that correct,
it's
Representative
line
12. Slawick?
Okay, so it's line. It says line 10. Page 23, line 10. After the second the, insert Commissioner of Management and Budget for transfer to the.
State subsidized identification card account. I believe it, it goes then to.
So, Madam Chair, it's taking money from the general fund and transferring it to the Commissioner of Management and Budget for the identification cards. Is that correct?
I guess Mr. Marks wants to weigh in here on this one.
Mr. Chair and Representative Slawick, it's more technical. The in the bill. The money wasn't is just appropriated, and it wasn't identified to who. This is saying it's appropriated to the Commissioner of MMB to transfer to this account. So it's pretty much a technical. It's a way to get money from the general fund to this voter ID account, and making the Commissioner of MMB responsible for doing that.
Okay. Madam Chair,
Representative Slawick,
Mr. Marks. So that's just the. I guess it's, it seems a little bit unusual to me. I'm not sure we've seen a lot of that, but I guess. That obviously is protocol, or it's there's some kind of precedence where we've done that before.
Mr. Marks,
Madam Chair, and Representative Slawick, it's that seemed like the logical commissioner to move money from one fund to another fund, and then the money will sit in that account until DPS, Department of Public Safety, uses it, which is specified in an earlier section in here. So it's. Okay. I think that this is all basically an accounting-type function, and that's why it seemed like MMB should do it.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking, Ms. Representative Kiffmeyer, on lines 14 and 15 of your amendment, and maybe I haven't got the whole bill in hand here, but it's looking to me like in the Section 34 appropriations, that is one-time money. It's talking about fiscal year 2013, fiscal year 2012, 2013. But then when we get to lines 14 and 15 on the amendment, it's permanent funding. Is this new, or is this just, you said it was kind of technical, this amendment, but is that somewhere else in the bill too, and now we're just putting it here, or is this brand new that it's ongoing funding?
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Greiling. It was in the fiscal note, but was it inadvertently left off of the language? And so we felt we needed to account for that here.
And Representative Greiling, what this accounts for is continuing costs of subsidizing the voter ID cards. We don't know exactly what the level of need will be. We know that in the first year it will be higher than subsequent years, so that's why you see the $709,000 in the first election year to accomplish this, and then the base funding would be for continuing costs, and then the language in the amendment would assure that unexpended funds from this appropriation revert back to the general fund. So in other words, if they don't have enough need to meet this level of appropriation, the additional money would revert to the general fund. Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So then this ongoing $215,000 was already discussed in all the committees, and because it was in the fiscal note and it was assumed in governmental ops or state government finance or wherever this went, that this money was here. We're not seeing it for the first time in Ways and Means then.
No, that's correct, Madam Chair.
Representative Kiffmeyer. And members, this the funding for this particular bill, unlike the other ones that we heard earlier today that were included in other omnibus bills, this particular bill will be funded off the other bills line on the spreadsheet, which there was, I don't know, 50, I can't remember where the last amendment where we're at, but there's far excess money in that line item. And so when we do further spreadsheets for the committee, this bill will be there'll be a line item with the cost for this bill accounted for there.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, any additional questions on the A45 amendment? If not, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Amendment's adopted. And then I think there's one additional amendment here, the reimbursement of local costs. I believe that's Representative Kahn's amendment.
Mr. Madam Chairman, I believe you received a local impact fiscal note. Did you distribute it to the committee?
They're in the packet.
Yeah. It's in the packet?
Yeah.
Okay, yes. Yep.
Members, it should be in your packet.
I have one. I can't find it in my packet. Okay, I have it. Okay. Well, this, are there any, does the author have any comments on the local impact fiscal note, which has a really big number on it?
Representative Kiffmeyer, you had an opportunity to review the local impact note.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Kahn and members, I have, it just came out today, and I did take a look through it. I don't think that this, first of all, this is an option to local units of government, and so this is quite presumptive of saying, talking about costs related to poll book procurement, maintenance, storage, insurance, and policy when there is no decision as yet, since it's an option of the local units of government to do such of a purchase if they wish to do this. So there is no mandate to local governments, and this is an option for them to exercise. And as yet, nobody has or would be able to exercise that option since this is not yet passed into law.
Well,
Representative Kahn.
Okay, Madam Chairman, what happens if they don't adopt it? What happens then? How do they work? How are they able to meet the mandates of the bill then?
There is no
Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Kahn. There is not a mandate here, Representative Kahn. It's an option. And if the local units of government find that this is a option that would be beneficial to them, it is their option to choose to do that.
So how
Representative Kahn.
Madam Chairman, could you explain how it would work if they don't what happens if they don't? What's the process if they don't adopt these? How does it all work out?
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Madam Chair and Representative Kahn, if they choose not to adopt making use of the electronic poll books, then they are able to use the paper verification lists that would be produced for them by the county.
Ms. O'Connor, did you have another question?
Yes.
Or did you
do we have an estimate as to the paper costs in terms of doing that? Apparently there's then problems with needing extra election judges for that.
Is that Representative Kiffmeyer?
Madam Chair and Representative Kahn, there is no extra judges required. The voter registration judge, as usual, would make use of, they've had student housing lists, they have several kinds of things that would be provided to them, and my expectation is that the regular election judges at that time would make use of that additional tool made available to them.
Representative Kahn.
It seems to me that in discussing this bill, we've had a big push. We've had a big discussion about how the electronic poll books, because of the electronic database, et cetera, is going to be something that really facilitates the process. But now it's considered to be optional. And it's considered to be, and then I don't understand how the process works without this in each area. I don't know. I do know we have an election judge, the head of elections from Hennepin County here, and maybe she could give her opinions on this section and on the costs and on this local and on this fiscal note, which.
So, Representative Kahn, what is the specific question you're trying to
answer? Well, my question is, should we have an appropriation of $23 million in this bill or not? Or should we have some lesser money, amount of money in it? And how will the system work without the facilitation with the electronic poll books?
Well, Madam Chair.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just think that, you know, Representative Kahn, one of the things that I think is, it's been an important component here is that the option is an option. It's a local option. It is not a mandate. Elections are already conducted by local units of government. They already have the election judges to fulfill those requirements and processing all of those. So I would expect that if this is an option that is beneficial to them, has a return on investment, that would be a local decision. This to me does not reflect that option and choice of local units of government. It is treating it as if it were a mandate, and that is not the case.
Well, the problem, Madam Chairman.
Representative Kahn.
If you look at the second page of the local fiscal note, we get to the costs related to the electronic poll books. We then get to the second bullet, which is the costs related to the provisional ballot voting requirement, including in the bill, including staff and resources for the monitoring, et cetera, separate storage and so forth. None of that is optional. None of the things after, if you just say the electronic poll books is optional, none of the rest of it, and you go on, so I'm looking at page 2, I'm looking at the bullets after that. None of that, except for the one again where it gets to electronic poll books, none of that is optional after that.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Kahn and members, remembering that local units of government are required to conduct elections. They have election judges in the polling place. They have registration judges. They have election judges who conduct this process. And the county staff also have staff already at the county and they are there to take care of questions and issues from their citizens and customers, and that is a part of their current duties, and they already have those office hours established to do that. So I see those costs that are there as already part of the local unit of government requirement to conduct elections, and every year or 2 years or so, we always do have some election laws that are changing, and it has been customary for those updates to be put forward to the local units of government and for them to incorporate them into their conduct of elections.
Well, Representative Kahn.
Madam Chairman, except, you know, this is much more than we've ever done in any year in terms of the conduct conducting of elections. We've never had the all of the items related to provisional ballots. So if we cut off the amount for the electronic poll poll books, saying that that's optional, although I think with all the descriptions of these bills, we had a big pitch about how wonderful the electronic poll books are going to make the whole system. So it doesn't seem quite so optional to me. But there's still a large amount of money. I think that takes out of the $23 million, that takes $19 million away. But there still is a whole chunk of other, bunch of other millions that are left in the cost of the note. And so I don't, so, I mean, are you saying that this is wrong? Should we have some discussion with the people who prepared it? Or what's, you know, what are you saying about this note?
Well, Madam Chair.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Last year we passed the absentee ballot boards. It was a fairly significant change of elections. And this was administered, again, by local units of government. And so I just want to let you know that there have been those kinds of changes that we have done before, and the local units of government participated in that as well. In regards to the extending the retention period of election materials to 36 months, it was interesting in the last two recounts that many times attorneys requested to see election materials, and that it takes a little while for some of these procedures and processes to go through. And in many cases, these election materials were already being retained for longer than the 22 months. So that many times it's a matter of the recount process of going through that. So again, they are required, and in the past we changed it from a retention of election materials, I believe it was from 12 months to 22 months, and then this is the 36 months, but in many cases they are already being retained, and they are very helpful and material to the elections. In general, the costs in regards to the absentee boards meeting every day during the balloting period, again, this is staff time being used, as I observed, in regards to the at the county, and the one that I went to. But I think that some of these things have a fairly strong assumption in them, again, that it is a local option and that the local units of government are required to conduct elections, and these are just a part of election administration.
Well,
Representative
Kahn. Madam Chairman, as I recall, and I might need someone to help me with some of these, as I recall, in the last election, we did reimburse local units of government for a lot of their additional costs because of the HAVA funds were available. I don't know if Beth Fraser wants to speak to this, but we've canceled the HAVA funds in the state government finance bill because you're, I guess, using them in this bill. So I don't know. So I think we had money to help local units of government in the last election that's not going to be available for these following elections.
Madam Chair.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative Kahn, I think those items you are referring to were in a specific bill, and those were appropriated to the Secretary of State that had to do with mainly IT type of adjustments to the IT program. I don't have the bill right in front of me at this time, but they were very specific things tied to the use of the federal money that were appropriated to the Secretary of State. And each of those amounts, Representative Kahn, had a specific dollar number with them, and they were appropriated to the Secretary of State and were testified to that these were the amounts needed to complete that project.
Well, Madam Chairman and members, I guess I'd like to move the A42 amendment.
Representative Kahn moves the A42 amendment.
And this is, I had another amendment withdrew, which appropriated a large number of money. Know, kind of following what we had thought was the local fiscal impact one, but agreeing in a sense with the Secretary of State that we're not sure what what the costs are going to be, I just decided to give some comfort to the local units of government who believe that they're looking at terrific costs to reimburse this, to just say that we intend, because we won't have it until I guess the next election, so that we intend to reimburse the costs incurred by counties to implement the requirements of this act. So if the electronic poll book is not a requirement, that would not be implemented, and that the Secretary of State shall then conduct a cost survey to determine the appropriate reimbursement for each unit of government. And since we're back here before the next election, we'll certainly be able to get those numbers in place.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Kahn. This same kind of amendment was defeated in a previous committee for the concept that, I don't know how you would put that in any ways and means dollar amount, blank check. I don't know that this committee that I've ever seen takes a unknown dollar amount and places it into statute in such a way that you don't even have a dollar amount, and also the just many issues here, but this is an amendment that was defeated in a previous committee.
Well,
Representative Kahn.
Madam Chairman, we didn't have, of course, the fiscal note in that previous, the local impact fiscal note in this previous committee. We do have a local impact fiscal note now, and you don't think we should meet the numbers that are in that local impact fiscal note. Note, which I would put into the bill if that was true. Well, and I think this is a statement. This is a statement of intent. It is not, we do not say, an open appropriation would say there is appropriated as much money as is necessary to reimburse the purposes of the act. We're admitting that we don't know what that number is because we don't know what the full requirements are. But I think if this, you know, I mean, I guess I stand by the language in this bill, in this amendment. I think that we should intend to reimburse the local units of government, which are going to be very badly strapped by many things that the legislature is doing with it, and it is not the same as an appropriate. It is not the same as an open appropriation. And the clear thing, if we decide it's a number, if when we're back next year and we know what's been passed and we know exactly, and local units of government have a better idea of what they're going to have to do to meet the requirements of the act, we can then put a number in last year. And if we decide that that number is such that we don't want to, we can then just repeal this section. But I think the idea of telling us that we're not going to put an additional burden on the backs of local government is one that I strongly support.
Representative Wagenius, to this point. Okay.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to support Representative Kahn, but for a different reason than the one she brought up. I mean, not that her reason isn't good, but one of the things that is troubling me about this whole concept of some local units of government are going to do it, some are not, is that we have just been through a recount where absentee ballots were handled differently in one jurisdiction and from another jurisdiction.
And we realized that that was a big mistake. We were told it was a big mistake, and so we went back and fixed it. And now we're setting up the same possibility again of having some local units do one thing and some do another. And I would draw your attention to page 4 of the local impact fiscal notes, where the writer of the fiscal note down in the middle paragraph said half the survey respondents projected that they would purchase electronic poll books in order to carry out the provisions in the bill effectively. Okay, so their assumption is they without the money would be ineffective, so we're going to have some effective poll places and some ineffective poll places. We can't do that. I think we have to assume that everybody gets the money and that we say, yes, you all have, all voters need to be treated the same. So, Representative Akon, I support you, but I think there is another reason, for, in my judgment, that everybody has to have. If one group is going to have them to be effective, everybody needs them to be effective.
Thank you, Representative Guineas. Representative Champion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I don't have the benefit, unfortunately, of being on state government and haven't had the opportunity to hear the testimony of local units of government to be able to say, when I read this legislation and if it becomes law, here is how I interpret its impact on me. And it just appears to me that there is some local impact and that there's a mandate in this bill. So, Madam Chair, I know that you don't ordinarily like to have any testimony, but I would ask if you would be so kind as to consider letting us have some abbreviated testimony, just maybe from a local unit of government or even the Secretary of State's office, to really say, when we look at this legislation, here is the potential impact, especially a local unit of government, just so I can have a really clear sense, so I can, you know, decide if I'm going to support the Con amendment or not.
Thank you. And I'm happy to do that in a brief form, and I'm not so sure if it's Ms. Frazier or a local person. Either one is
Ms.
fine.
Smith from Hennepin County is here.
Yeah. All right, Ms. Smith, if you'd like to step to the stand, please. If you'll state your name for the record, welcome to the committee, and I think you heard Representative Champion's concerns, and if you can help sort out for the committee what you view, what the costs may be, and how you view what's mandated in the bill versus what's optional.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Rachel Smith, the Hennepin County Elections Manager, and we did respond to the local impact note, so I can, you know, address any of those concerns. When we responded to the local impact note, they asked us, you know, if these were all the requirements of the bill, how would you implement? And, of course, we've looked at all sorts of options. This is, I think, maybe the fourth or fifth one we've responded to. We looked at it from electronic poll books with internet connectivity, you know, in each of the polling places. Then we looked at, well, what if we just had electronic poll books without the internet connectivity in the polling places? Then we looked at a third option, which would be electronic poll books just for people that are registering by election day, and then having paper rosters, so having kind of a hybrid in a polling place. And finally, we looked at just the paper system. Mm-hmm. And so those are the kind of the range of things that we've been evaluating throughout the whole process. The main concern at this point is that the bill still requires a 42-day post-election entry of all the election day registrations and the voting history. In Hennepin County alone, we got 130,000 election day registrations in 2008. And it's going to be really, when we looked at how we would ever get within the 42-day deadline or 42 days, we were thinking that it would take close to 40 full-time temporary staff along with supervisors that would supervise that operation. And it just... logistically, along with some of the other post-election duties that we've been doing, like the post-election audit that we're doing. We've also had recounts on top of that. We simply just don't know that we could meet the time restrictions without having an electronic poll book of some kind, whether it be just for Election Day registrations or it be for everyone. The time frame in which we are basically dispatching paper to 425 polling places for 500,000 to 600,000 people on Election Day, based on the requirements of the bill, just simply can't be met with some form of electronic issue. And that's basically how we evaluated and processed our options. I think the other big, the other bigger items that to consider, of course, the provisional voting. When we did change, when you changed the absentee provisions, many of the people in the polling places that were working on absentees, you needed almost one full-time person dedicated to working on absentee ballots. We think that that would also be the case based on our research with other states that use provisional voting, that we would need one additional election judge in each of our polling places all day. So I think we also have some concerns about the voter education. Of course, if people do not get the message, we're going to be concerned about fielding those calls or absorbing those calls. I would say the other big one is the requirement to convene an absentee ballot board on a daily basis or every day. Many cities or townships that do have an absentee ballot board are not necessarily using staff because it does require a party balance, and some of the election staff are not comfortable stating a political party preference. So many times we're using election judges that can come in, and to call in election judges on a daily basis, even if there's no work to do, you'd have to pay them something for their time and their mileage. So we do anticipate that could be probably more difficult to some of our smaller cities and jurisdictions. So that's basically when we evaluated. I think there's more, but that's basically what we've kind of evaluated as we went through.
All right, thank you. Any questions for Ms. Smith? Representative Champion.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. Ms. Smith, again, thank you. So when you talk about the provisional ballots or the paper system, you articulated some added cost that you would incur even if you don't use the electronic component. Is that right?
Ms. Smith.
Madam Chair, Representative Champion, yes. Some of the additional cost, of course, would be the requirement. Right now we have, the bill requires now that we do a 42-day, we have to do all of our data, complete all of our data entry and all of our, we scan the rosters for posting history, it's called. And we have to do that within 42 days, and we have the option to extend that time period, which we do have to use. And of course, we hope that we can do our best to get it as quickly as possible, but when we've been facing recounts and post-election duties, it's pretty difficult to get, like I said, 130,000 Election Day registrations entered in, along with scanning rosters for 425 polling places.
Final question, Madam Chair.
Representative Champion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Smith, so I hope I'm calling your last name right. I just hope I wrote that down right because I don't ever like to be disrespectful. Looking at some of the costs that you've talked about, it's my understanding that there would also, sort of reading through the information, be some additional costs for a longer retention of documents. I don't know if that's true, but looking at the potential costs, you've given us many different scenarios that you all looked at when you responded to the local impact note. I don't know if you can tell us with any degree of certainty what your additional costs would be, and I know that you would be talking about your additional costs if you looked at any of the various scenarios that you so eloquently articulated earlier, just so we can get a sense of what that additional cost would be, so that if Representative Kahn felt moved, she could potentially think in terms of what number should be put into her amendment, if any.
Ms. Smith.
Madam Chair, Representative Champion, I think we can say that we did work with other city and county organizations. The electronic poll books, I'm guessing, would be mostly for the larger metro counties because of the volume, and the but some of the other costs related to storage. We did kind of try to come up with a consistent number to apply, and we used, in our case, we were able to get about $8 per square foot. So for Hennepin County, just the storage for that, you know, the extra time frame was about $50,000 annually. That would be one. We looked at the additional cost of provisional voting. That's about $400,000. And that was with the assumption that one election judge per polling place would be hired, along with the costs associated with printing additional materials, having some kind of storage, secured storage at each of our polling places, in addition to the time after election day that we would be spending to make sure we process the provisional ballots correctly, the delayed canvass, things like that. I hope that helps address.
Yes, thank you, Ms. Smith. Any other questions for Ms. Smith? Representative Abler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Speaking of local impact notes, I don't know if Hennepin County calculated it, but Anoka County certainly did when Ms. Smith was stolen by Hennepin County away from Anoka to run their programs, and so she did great work in Anoka. So it's good to see her landed well, and you gain. Congratulations, Representative Champion.
Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I strongly support this amendment. I hate to, however, spend, whether it's state or local dollars, $23 million, on something like this. When we have, local government, everything we do around here, we're trying to do mandate reduction, government redesign. Cities and counties are losing local government aid, but yet we're putting this kind of an expensive mandate on them. The least we can do then is pay for it. I find it ironic that this bill comes after Representative Downey's two bills trying to find ways where we can save money. I don't know if Representative Downey is listening. I'm going to be very curious to see how the votes go on this bill. I'm one who's willing to spend money if it's something that I think is worthwhile, and my yardstick for if it's worthwhile this year is looking at what could we do with this money. Is it a higher calling or not compared to if we spent it for early childhood? We keep talking about that bipartisanly, and it's a small budget, and if we could just have a small amount of money for it, $23 million, I think statewide, Representative Slawik would go quite a long ways for early childhood. And we had Jeb Bush here last week who was saying that in Florida they had gains with students at risk. One of the things they did was fund early childhood. So I always have to, I think in this committee, it's our moral obligation to look not just, each finance committee looks only at that finance committee, but here we're supposed to be looking at ways and means and looking at all the budgets in some kind of a balance. And so I just have to point out that in my mind this is not a high calling amongst all the other things that we have. I have one city, the city of Lauderdale, that when I went, and they're going to lose local government aid, it's the only city I have that gets local government aid. But when I was at their meeting a month or two ago, they were debating what to do because they were going to have to cut. And really the only thing left to cut is their police officer. And I'm saying that in the singular, their police officer. They have one police officer for this tiny city. They rent the police officer from another city, so they're already doing the government redesign. But now they can't even afford, if they're going to lose local government aid, to keep the police officer all for 24 hours. So they were taking input on what hours of the 24 hours in the day did the community not want to have a police officer. And now we're going to have, I don't know what their share will be of this $23 million that's going to be an unfunded mandate for voting jurisdictions, But it seems to me that them getting to have a whole police officer and not less hours on the street would be a higher calling than this as well. So while I don't support spending any money on this bill, I certainly think if we are going to, those of us who are prioritizing it, or even if we're not, which will be me, we should at least pay for what we mandate on local government. So I hope we all vote yes for the Kahn Amendment.
Thank you, Representative Greiling. Representative Slavik, is your question for Ms. Smith?
It's a comment to this point.
All right. Thank you,
Ms.
Smith.
Thank you.
Representative Slavik.
Thank you. Well, Madam Chair and members, this is very similar to how it went in state government finance. It almost seems like Groundhog Day, where it's the same thing, because we also had Ms. Smith come up, but we did not have the $23 million fiscal note. And part of the frustration here is this is Ways and Means. This is where we're supposed to be doing the fiscal process, and this is what happened in the committee, is we have authors of bills that don't agree with fiscal notes, so they start to pick them apart and say they're going to refuse parts of them. And Madam Chair, I just think this is a problem overall. We know this session is going to come down to fiscal notes and how we're counting them and who believes what in them and what parts we're going to take and not take. And if we don't start to get some agreement, it's going to be a long, even longer end to our session. That being said, we did do this exercise once already. I think this is a good amendment, though, because this time we do have the true cost, $23 million. And as Representative Greiling talks about, as far as an unfunded mandate, it's a property tax increase. You know who's going to pay for that. It's going to be the people in our cities, our taxpayers, the middle class, are going to be now paying for voter ID through increased property taxes. So it seems when we request, and my understanding is when you look at who MMB wrote the fiscal note too. It's the, I see Representative Lancheski is there. It looks like it's what the tax chairs, the and the Ways and Means chairs, is these, they can request these local impacts notes, but if we're going to ignore them when they come in, it makes you wonder why we're doing them. So it's either we pay attention to them and accept what they are and make a decision on it that way, we ignore them, or we go ahead and pass them on as an unfunded mandate to our voters, to our constituents, and have them now picking up the costs on their property taxes for this. So I just think that we should support this amendment, but I should think we should think about what we're doing with voter ID and if the costs are worth it when we have an election system that has very little fraud in it.
Well, Madam Chairman,
Representative Kahn.
I guess I'll ask for a roll call vote on the amendment.
All right, thank you. Representative Kiffmeyer, you look like you've been wanting to add to this discussion.
Yes, thank you very much, Madam Chair. Just to note, though, that this 42-day deadline has been in law since the Help America Vote Act was passed. What has happened, though, is that some counties have sought a waiver every election year. But this is not only a matter of state law, but it is a matter of also required by federal law. Matter of fact, even 42 days. And so to seek extra funds because it's already been in law and you're already required to do it, I think this has been something in place for quite a while. In regards to the provisional ballots, as a matter of information, Wisconsin had about 400 provisional ballots last year, and Indiana, which also requires voter ID, had about 2,500 provisional ballots last year. And so sometimes, especially with the ID requirements and some of those things, what you will find is that in many cases, especially at the public education campaign, that this is a area that it is common to talk about as if there's going to be a much larger number, but in fact, in the case here with Wisconsin and Indiana, it is a much lower. So I just feel that that's an important piece of information that might be helpful to you to know. And Madam Chair, I would ask for no vote on this amendment, blank check amendment.
Are there additional comments on the or questions on the A40... amendment?
Well, just
Representative Kahn?
Just a correction. It's not if it were a blank check, it would be an open appropriation. This is not a blank check. It is just recognizing, particularly with this local with this impact statement that there are going to be additional costs in the state or to pick these up in times of very trying times for local units of government. And if we decide with more information, when we know exactly what the form of the bill is, and when we've done this cost survey from the Secretary of State to do it, we'll have next year to decide whether we're going to meet it or whether we're just going to let it sit on the local units of government. So I urge a yes vote.
All right. Thank you, Representative Kahn. Representative Carlson.
Madam Chair, I had 2 points I wanted to make. One was I was going to request that Ms. Smith have an opportunity to testify, and I was the one that requested the fiscal note, and we unfortunately, due to the timing and so on, and I'm not saying this in a critical way, we weren't able to get it until later today. We were hopeful that it would be available this morning. But I do want to reemphasize before we vote on the amendment that there's a reason that we have fiscal notes, or in this case a local impact note, and we should pay attention to those because, as has been pointed out, there will be a cost to local units of government. We heard good testimony from Hennepin County just a few moments ago. And, you know, if the state doesn't fund it, there will be, as was pointed out, in all likelihood, then an impact on the local property tax. And as you know, in this committee, as different bills have gone through, I've tried to point that out several times, whether it was the tax bill or some of the other bills that we knew in the end were going to have an impact on the property tax. So I would encourage people to support the amendment.
Thank you, Representative Carlson. Chair Davids, is your committee adjourned?
No, we're recessed till 8:30.
You're recessed till 8:30 because I want to make sure that everybody was here for a roll call.
Madam Chair, I did want to comment on the bill, too, before.
Yeah.
I was commenting now on the amendment, but I do want to make a comment or two about the bill before you vote on the final. I'll be brief.
Representative Carlson, Representative Kahn requested a roll call on the amendment.
Yeah.
So we need to vote on the amendment. I just wanted to make sure that I had a note from some of our members that were on the tax committee that wanted to be here for any roll call votes.
And I'm one of those tax people. So,
all right. Okay. Then Representative Kahn renews her motion that Amendment A42 be adopted and has requested a roll call vote.
Representative Holberg.
No.
Representative Downey.
No.
Representative Carlson.
Aye.
Representative Abler.
No.
Representative Bruce Anderson.
No.
Representative Sarah Anderson.
No.
Representative Beard.
Nay.
Representative Breinert.
Yes.
Representative Biskins.
No.
Representative Champion.
Yes.
Representative Davids.
No.
Representative Eakin.
Yes.
Representative Garofalo. Representative Greiling.
Aye.
Representative Gunther.
No.
Representative Hackbarth.
No.
Representative Hornstein.
Yes.
Representative Howes.
No.
Representative Kahn.
Yes.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
No.
Representative Lanning.
No.
Representative Lincheski.
Yes.
Representative McNamara. Representative Nornes. Representative Pulowski.
Yes.
Representative Rukavina. Representative Slawick.
Yes.
Representative Wagenius.
Yes.
Representative Westrom.
No. We occasionally get this.
With 11 yeses and 17 noes, the motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. We now have Senate File 509 as amended. I don't see any other amendments in the packet. Representative Wagenius, and if I might, Chair Davids, you're in recess. You said till 8:15. It's past that.
8:30.
If you are planning on making more comments or statements, could you raise your hand so we know whether or not we want to send the tax people back to taxes and recess again, or if we're going to make this go quick and get them back to committee? Okay, I think we can quickly finish this. Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Since we are about ready to take a vote, I will be quick. This is the first time I've had an opportunity to hear this bill, and I am still wrestling with why we're doing it, but it is my understanding that you want to avoid fraudulent votes in Minnesota. And, of course, I think that is something that everybody wants to avoid, and that's one of the reasons we have a criminal justice system. Good for it. I have totaled up the cost to state government. It's $5.18 million. And the total cost to local governments, assuming we don't fund that, it would be local governments, that's $23 million. So it's a $28.5 million bill for this bill to prevent fraudulent votes from being cast. Well, the number of fraud convictions in the last election was 38. So that's the number of fraud that was known. So what you are doing is having Minnesotans spend $750,000 per fraudulent vote. That's outrageous.
Representative Carlson?
Yeah. First of all, I'd like to request a roll call on passage. But I, too, will make my comments somewhat brief. But, you know, we are a fiscal committee, and we talk about the cost to the state and local units of government. But there's also costs built in here to the individual. And I'm going to use a family member, my mother, as an example. One of the advantages of the internet while we were talking here, I looked up a bit of the family tree, and my great-grandfather was born in 1859 in Austin, Minnesota. Looks to me like when I look up the family tree here that they arrived in Austin, Minnesota between 1853 and 1857. The reason I point that out, my mother then was born in Austin, Minnesota as well, and the family was among the original settlers of Austin. She happened to be a home birth and was attended by a doctor. The doctor didn't file the papers for a birth certificate. My mother worked, they moved to the Twin Cities, and she worked for many years for the Bloomington schools, and when she retired, she wanted to take a trip to Europe. She needed a passport. To get the passport, she needed a birth certificate. One didn't exist. But you can get one if you can get three ways of verifying that you were born in the United States, or in this case, in Minnesota. One of the things you can look at is a newspaper article to get one of the three to see if you were identified as having been born on the date that you were told you were born or whatever. All the Austin newspaper had was baby girl born on August 2nd, 1917. So that wasn't enough. Fortunately, she had two older brothers. They could swear a statement that she was, in fact, a U.S. citizen born here. We were able to get a 1920 census that listed her, but that all took work. And I forget what the third one was, but we did have to, we were able to use school records. But my point is, that took us 2 years before we were able to get all of that resolved and get her, in her case, her birth certificate so she could get her passport. It took several trips to Austin, Minnesota. It took, because she was living up here, just a whole lot of work. Well, now we're making that kind of a requirement on people that are in situations where they don't have a birth certificate readily available. Some of us, or probably all of us, received some information from the League of Women Voters. The reason I mentioned my mother and that information, they said something like 18% of the senior citizens don't have picture ID. So that's photo ID. Well, that's one problem, and I just shared with you what my mother went through to just kind of get things started. So it's not an easy process sometimes. The other thing is young people. They pointed out between 18 and 26, there's about 20% of them that don't have a photo ID. So you're really putting a lot of burden on individuals who are U.S. citizens, are entitled to vote, to get that photo ID. So there's not only the cost to state and local units of government, and my point is that there's a whole lot of cost to individuals. And my mother was probably one. She was very interested in government and politics. She probably would have went through all the hoops. Might have missed an election, being that it took 2 years, but she probably would have done that because she was active in the League of Women Voters and just followed politics very closely. But a lot of people probably won't have the resources or won't have the motivation, if you will, to go through all of that simply to get a photo ID so they can vote. So I have a lot of concerns about this bill, and I would urge a no vote.
Thank you, Representative Carlson. I think there was one hand over here. Representative Greiling, briefly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will try to be briefly. I think that, as Representative Wagenia said, $750,000 per fraudulent vote is way too high of a price to pay for this bill, and that's its recommendation, to try to ferret out those few fraudulent votes. But that's a very, very high price to pay. We could think of a lot more things in government where we could get a better deal than $750,000 per fraudulent vote. And but the cost to me is not it even pales in comparison with the whole premise of this bill, which is putting roadblocks in front of people voting. We got rid of the poll tax. We got rid of people having to pass reading tests or whatever. But now, as Representative Carlson said, this to me is a gatekeeper of your frontal lobe brain executive function. And if you can get all these things together and then come to the polls and be that organized, and that would be all right if this was a privilege. But in my mind, and I think in everybody's mind, including Representative Zellers, who any reader of the Constitution, voting is a right. And so when we put roadblocks in there and they're this expensive, I see no redeeming qualities whatsoever for this bill. And I would hope that when we explain it really well to the voters of Minnesota, that they will see it that way as well. I think that, we look at the polls of how vast numbers of Minnesotans support this bill, but I don't think they know exactly what it means and how much it costs.
Let's see. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, I ask for your support for this bill. Just to clarify, the 38 number has been repeated over and over again, and I have testified over and over again that it is not accurate. From the 2008 election, there are many more, 99 convictions to this point, and more as they go through the process. There are 399 that are reported to the county attorney's office just from the 2010 election. With the postal verification cards being returned, the 2008 number of about 28,000 postal verification cards, no such name, no such address, and granted there may be some of those that are just typos or other things, even still, it is a big number. But the other point is that how do you know without photo ID in a state that has vouching, no ID, and same-day registration? This is an upfront integrity provision. Minnesota and the talk about the excellent system we have is mostly referring to the recounting and counting. I believe this will also, by increasing the upfront integrity of our election system, reduce the recounts at the end of the process and help to save those dollars there as well. And this is a right, but it is a qualification to be met also in our Constitution that has to do with age, citizenship, and residency. So I believe that this is a well-balanced bill that you will be able to support, and I ask for your vote. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Kiffmeyer renews her motion that Senate File 509, as amended, be recommended to pass and refer to the General Register. A roll call has been requested.
Representative Holberg.
Yes.
Representative Downey.
Yes.
Representative Carlson.
No.
Representative Abler.
Yes.
Representative Bruce Anderson.
Yes.
Representative Sarah Anderson.
Yes.
Representative Beard.
Aye.
Representative Brainerd.
No.
Representative Biskins.
Aye.
Representative Champion.
No.
Representative Davids.
Yes.
Representative Eakin.
No.
Representative Garofalo.
Yes.
Representative Greiling.
No.
Representative Gunther.
Yes.
Representative Hackbarth.
Aye.
Representative Hamilton. Representative Hornstein.
No.
Representative House.
Yes.
Representative Huntley. Representative Kahn.
No.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Aye.
Representative Lanning. Representative Lincheski.
Yes.
Representative McNamara.
Yes.
Representative Nornes.
Yes.
Representative Pawlowski.
Representative Pawlowski is unknown.
Representative Rukavina. Representative Slawick.
No.
Representative Smith. Representative Wagenius.
No.
Representative Westrom.
Yes.
I have voted 18 to 10. The Kiffmeyer motion prevails. The bill is on its way to the General Register. Members, there's no more business to come before the committee. Tonight, we will be meeting Wednesday evening. I did have a discussion with the minority leader. It's my understanding that the minority is having a caucus following session on Wednesday. We'll allow plenty of time for the minority members to attend their caucus, and so I'm guessing it'll be in the evening, and we have quite a lengthy agenda, so that's plans for Wednesday night. With that, we're adjourned.
There you go.